Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates?
With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard.
Find out today why ZipRecruiter is being used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/shock. That's ZipRecruiter.com/shock. One more time, try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/shock.
Okay, and welcome to episode number 61 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo. I'm sitting here with Mr. Elric Kane.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, man.
What'd you do to Turk? What'd you do?
We tied him up. He's in the closet in the corner.
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, he gave me shit about liking the Dark Tower, so I
don't think he's
up.
Probably alone.
Didn't know when to shut up.
We're going to get to that. Also, Rebecca McKendry is with us.
Hello.
Hello, Becca. How are you?
Doing well.
Excellent. Doctor?
Doctor?
Doctor? Are we still talking?
You guys haven't called me that in like a year.
We forgot.
That's okay. I'll let it slide.
So welcome back to the show. Ryan is obviously not with us this week, but he will return next week. However, Exploitation Month continues. Mm-hmm. We got two really fantastic guests coming later in the show.
And a whole bunch of titles you have never heard of. I guarantee, no matter how savvy you are, that you have not heard of at least one thing that we say today.
Yes. Usually when somebody from Bleeding Skull is on, we are stumped.
Yeah.
There's at least one title.
Some weird shit.
So there's some good stuff coming up. And obviously, we're going to talk about what we've seen lately. Mm-hmm. But really, you know, to bring it up off the top of the show, the last episode we recorded, again, was a little bit earlier than usual. So in the interim, unfortunately, really sad to hear that one of our listeners and supporters named Dustin Pace has passed away. Very talented artist, died at 33, very abruptly. And he was with his wife Tiffany at Texas Frightmare and came and talked to us and hung out at the actual live show that we did.
He was absolutely amazing.
And
so
really
fun.
Really talented kid and really sweet person. We had a couple of conversations over the weekend. And obviously, if you look at our group photo, we did it after we did the Texas Frightmare episode. We had everybody that was wearing a Shockwave shirt come up and do a group photo with us. And Dustin's right there in the middle. And I was just really, it's one of us. And I'm really sad about it. And obviously, our thoughts go out to Tiffany, his wife, and the family. And this episode is dedicated to Dustin.
Duddy in Motion.
Duddy in Motion.
On Twitter. Yep. And a bunch of people who, knew him and interacted with him specifically on Twitter, which he was one of the positive guys on Twitter. That's the thing. One of the guys who would actually try to cheer up your day.
Yes.
Unlike so much of the misery on there. Somebody started, I think it was Mike D at Splat House. I'm not sure. One of them started a
GoFundMe.
Is it a GoFundMe? Yeah. GoFundMe. Yeah. To help out because there's, this came very suddenly in their lives and they are not ready for it. And, it'd be great if anyone is out there who can help, check something their way. We don't usually do things like this, obviously.
Yeah.
But in this case, it meant something personal.
He was part of the family.
Yeah. And I think we posted the links to the GoFundMe, but we'll reshare them this weekend after this episode airs so that if you're able to help out a little bit, then please do.
Yeah.
So this one's for you. All right. So the latest horrors. Here we go.
Yeah.
You want me to kick it off with my controversial pick?
Yeah, because you are the only one of us who saw Dark Tower.
And the only one on Earth who sits on
That's not true.
But it is on Twitter.
I know at least five people. Well, Twitter's not real life,
but you go on Twitter to bitch. That's what you're supposed to do while you're there.
Well, here's the thing. Okay, so I went to see the Dark Tower.
Having read it or not?
No, and that's the thing is I am not – I'm not just going to say I'm not a fan. It's just, you know, what are they? There's seven novels?
Yeah,
they're big. There's a lot of novels. I could just – that's part of King's world that I could never get into. So in theory, this movie is for me. Somebody that doesn't know the source material, that just wants a really easy way in at a brisk 90 minutes.
Yeah.
And not knowing it, I loved it. I thought it was fine. I thought it was a fun, entertaining film. Everybody's great in it. It comes down to a simple – I mean, look, I don't know how intricate the stories are. So maybe if you're into the books – you are maybe there's much more better things they could have picked to put into this one particular movie. But as far as being completely oblivious to it, it is a straightforward good versus evil. And
can you put yourself on the other shoe? Because I haven't seen it, so I have no opinion at all. But why the negative backlash from the non-King readers? What do you think that's coming from?
I've been trying to figure that out, but the honest truth is I don't know. Because I mean, I think a lot of it. I hate to say this, but I think there is actual I don't want to call it Twitter mentality, but the second something comes out – because everyone started like attacking me, like, well, but you didn't like The Mummy and how can you defend this? It's like that is apples and oranges. Mm-hmm. Like there is not an original thing in The Mummy. Mm-hmm. Like The Mummy is a just you could tell it is a hodgepodge movie of just all these other ideas and other movies that I love. Whereas The Dark Tower, like – yeah, it definitely hints at other things in Stephen King's world, but I loved that. That was kind of fun to me. And here's the thing. Where's my phone? Joe Madry is a good friend of mine, and he is kind of a King expert.
Right.
He's the one that has done all the pieces for Blumhouse.com that revolve around anything Stephen King related. When it comes to the books, I don't know anybody that knows them more thoroughly. And he also loved it. And I remember when he got out of it and we were talking about it, I brought his text up just so I could bring it. He's like, I'm glad you liked it. He's like, it resonated with me emotionally for two levels. One, the father and son stories. And two, the need for Jake to believe in and find other worlds. And to me, I'm like, what more do you want?
And it does change my feeling hearing that Joe likes it in the sense because he is somebody who I would have thought wouldn't have liked it given his expertise.
Well, the point is, it's not the mess that everybody says it is. Like, it is, if you had, if there was no internet and you just saw it blindly on, you know, because that's the thing is right now we're on a King resurgence.
Right.
And so to me, at least as a movie, as a quick 90 minute movie about just, you know, a gunslinger that fights monsters and is after the Man in Black, like, it's cool. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was cool. And, you know, they referenced that the kid has The Shining. Ooh. So it's like, I get all excited. I'm like, oh, this is totally cool to me. Like, this totally feels like if it, we were in the 90s again where we were getting all these King movies, it would totally fit in line with that. And it's not a mess at all. It's a totally, thoroughly entertaining movie. Now, I know people don't like it. And again, I don't know what the story is behind that. Maybe it's too bland for them. Maybe they just think it's straightforward. But here's the thing. Entertainment, you know, does it entertain you? Entertainment could be a lot of things. I would love an intricate, dense movie based on the source material, sure. But it's just sometimes I like just a popcorn movie, and that's all it is to me. And it was funny because for, you know, my birthday passed in between episodes, and Ryan got me the Art of the Dark Tower movie, and he was like handed to me like it was a joke, and I was like, dude, this is awesome.
Wow.
I actually appreciate it. I was like, no, I love these art books.
Yeah, yeah.
So he got it as a joke, and I was like, joke's on you because I liked the movie and I think this book is great.
Wow.
So that's just my two cents. Right. Take it or leave it. But I don't think it's
mess. I'll wait for, you know, on demand, but I will watch it.
Yeah. And I think it did well enough. And I know the plan is to do a series now as a prequel.
Oh, yeah. They're
or something like that. But I thought it was cool, and I hope they continue, especially with those actors in those roles.
I love Idris Elba in anything.
He's great. He's great. And you know what? The last thing I'll say, and it's not a spoiler, but if there is a sort of bordering on Western movie with a gunslinger in it, as long as he shoots a lot of people in the third act in an amazing action sequence, then I'm satisfied. And you get that. You get to see him kick ass as the gunslinger.
I'm game.
So to me, I'm like, that's all I want out of this movie. So that's my two cents. Anyway, what'd you guys see?
Nice. I, because we've been doing Exploitation Month, I've been on an exploitation kick. And considering, and I don't want to drag the whole room down, but considering all of the turmoil that happened last weekend, I revisited Billy Jack, which is not a horror film exactly. It is an exploitation film. And I will say it is a rape revenge film, straight up. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that one. But I will say I had seen that when I was a kid. Rewatched it in the 90s and been like, oh my God, this is so dated. And I rewatched it again two nights ago and I cried. It is like so
it changes
good
with the
now
times, yeah.
And so topical. And you're watching it. And I mean, it's from the late 60s and you're watching it now and you're like, dude, nothing's changed. Like, we've not gone anywhere. So I won't spend time on it, but I will say, see Billy Jack if you have not seen it. But then in addition to that, I watched a couple other exploitation movies like Burial Ground.
Yes.
Which, okay, so
Peter
Burial
Bark.
Ground. I had sworn, like Burial Ground, and I know we've talked about this kind of phenomenon on the show before, where I swear I'd seen Burial Ground. So when that fancy Blu-ray came out a couple of months ago, I was like, I've seen Burial Ground. I'll watch it again some night when I don't have anything else to watch. And this movie that I'm confusing Burial Ground with, I have no idea what it is. It had zombies in it. There was something about voodoo. There were people trapped in a cabin. And that – it had a moon. They kept looking at the moon. And that is what I thought Burial Ground was. And I still have no fucking clue what movie I thought it was.
Sounds like a zombie ripoff, like a zombie.
It was
that.
Something Italian, and it was like a zombie ripoff. Yeah. But I remember it had a voodoo angle to it anyway. And it wasn't that exciting, so I was like, eh, I'll watch it when I can. So this weekend I wasn't doing anything. I put in Burial Ground. Holy fucking shit. I had never seen that movie before. As soon as the little the weird-looking kid shows up, I was like, I've definitely never seen that before.
That's a man, baby.
I would never forget
one
that.
One of the craziest performances you'll see. Yeah.
Oh, my God. That movie went to places. I mean, the zombies were cool. I felt bad for the maggots that were clearly glued into place and, like, writhing to get off their faces. But, oh, my God, that film went places that I was like, and you knew it was coming, too.
See, I've only seen it on VHS, and so I really have to see this.
Oh, my gosh, you have to see the
Because I always really liked it, but it's one of those films I can't imagine what it would look like in HD.
Like, and it has this crazy, shocking moment. It's unlike anything you've seen. And you know that the film is going there, and then it does, and you're just like, oh, my God, this is so bananas is the only way I can describe it.
It is a work of art, I will say that. And bless Severin Films for restoring this thing in all its glory.
Yes. So if you've not seen 1981's Burial Ground, please check out Severin Films' fancy Blu-ray edition. It is amazing.
I saw a new film in the movie theaters that, hold on to your hats, kids, has unintentional Kathy's Curse reference.
What?
What?
In
no
a little movie
way.
Called Annabelle 2. There is a
direct... I haven't seen it yet either.
I don't want to bring you guys down, but that Pony Smasher knocked it out of the fucking park.
That's right here.
I've seen some people on Twitter being negative, and it kind of shocks me because I saw it with Dick, and I put it up there right under. For me, it goes in that universe just right under Conjuring 1. But
you go, David Sandberg.
On the story side, it's okay. Like, it's a pretty good story. On a directorial side, he is taking my favorite gags that he did in his various shorts and has made them into entire set pieces in a feature film. And there is a couple, I mean, I got to say sequence for sequence, there's about, I'd say five or six sequences, like horror sequences in this film that are just like absolutely wonderful. Like, you're in the hands of someone who is just completely playing the gag and like pulling you in. And then there's the cool thing, and I won't give any spoilers here, is my trepidation, not for him, a film by David Sandberg, but my trepidation, I really hated more or less the first one. The only scene like everyone I liked was the scene in the middle in the elevator that everyone talks about James Wan having directed. Mm-hmm. But it did nothing for me as a doll movie. It didn't capture the creepy essence of the part in Conjuring that is excellent. This movie outdoes that part of the Conjuring to me. It really nails the doll, but what it does – so surprisingly to me, as somebody went to go see this late at night going, how will he maintain something with the doll, is that there's a lot more to it than just the doll in terms of creature ideas and monster stuff. So if you're on the fence because you're like, oh, it's a doll movie, it really is a lot bigger than that. And that surprised me. And I loved where it went on a horror level. So whenever I would read after I started with Dick and we both turned to each other and like, that just like the guy just totally knocked it. Like this is like getting an opportunity and hitting a complete grand slam to me.
Wow.
In terms of craft, especially. But when I would start reading Twitter and people go, you know, not of course, again, we're talking about Twitter, but if somebody had a reaction of like, oh, dumb, not scary, it's like, really? Like, what do you go to a movie theater for? Because to me, as a movie theater experience, that it's, I love being played. I love somebody being in the hands of someone who actually knows how to build mm-hmm. a sequence and getting that sequence. So, and it's also cool because we, you know, we got to meet him and he's a super nice guy. So it's always cool when you're not lying and bullshitting someone that they actually nailed it. I really can't say enough.
To me, like, I mean,
that's
it's
a fun movie.
You just said it, like with people's reactions to that in The Dark Tower. It's like, what do you want?
Yeah, what do you
I don't understand.
Yeah, yeah.
What do people want out of movies these days?
But this one, I think I'll be excited to hear what everyone thinks on that level. But it really, it's like I could see a universe of different things spinning off from things that I saw in that movie. Then
yeah.
I'd be like, ooh, I could
sure
watch a whole movie about that character, you know?
Yeah.
And you ask what they want, Rob. I think they want to go online and bitch.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of, you know,
I
think that there's definitely kind of a nice
But and the reason why I think it's cool that it's coming from me before you guys is because I feel like, you know, I'd say, Rob, you're probably the target in time, like, taste that you would really like this movie.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm as like the outsider in terms of our taste for this kind of movie. And yet I totally loved it. And it hits all those things that the reason I go to Conjuring those movies is because I want to not sit back in judgment. I just want to like go on a ride. And,
and
James is such a good craftsman. He takes you on that. This is the first time of any of the sequels directed by anyone but James that it delivers on that same level. You know, it's similar, reminiscent obviously to what Mike Flanagan was able to do in Ouija 2, but the difference is I think Ouija is such a limited thing. Like, he's doing a lot with a little.
Yeah.
And I didn't really like where the film kind of ends in the act. This one does the opposite. Dolls are, you know, obviously there's a whole history of why dolls creep us the fuck out, and he just doubles down on that and then takes it to a whole new place. So for me, it was a lot more, even more effective than what Ouija 2 was able to do.
I'm totally on board.
Yeah.
So that was the new film I saw. I had a couple other ones, but I'll wait till we circle back.
I got one Blu-ray recommendation for you, and it's something that you talked about quite a while ago, probably on Killer POV, and it's a little movie called Amsterdam.
I actually think it was still on this
Dick
show, but
Moss.
Yeah.
It could have been, but this was something that I believe a listener gave to you.
Yes,
or
Jacob
us, or,
Samhan
that's
from
it, yeah.
Trivia.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it was recent, like a few, couple months ago, before the Blu-ray.
All right,
and previously,
so,
the only way that you could find this is Shameless, which is
yellow.
A UK company had put out a Region 2 DVD, and so you had to like have special stuff to watch it.
Well, the mighty Bill Lustig, who is a big fan of this director, Dick Mass, has putting this comes out at the end of the month, I believe, on August 29th.
Fits in perfectly to today's topic.
Oh my God, it's Amsterdam, and he's also doing his other film, The Lift.
That's the one I want to see.
I have not seen The Lift yet.
No,
I was talking about it with Rob before.
That
the
one's
movie.
Coming, getting this treatment in October. Right. But let me tell you something. Amsterdam is one of those gems that I absolutely freaking loved, and so much so that, well, first of all, look, so it takes place in Amsterdam, so there's all these canals that like run through the city, and it's a slasher movie where a diver uses the canals to like jump out of the canal and kill people.
But it also opens like from a Jaws perspective.
Oh,
basically.
Totally.
You
it's
think
like a POV shot. Like, I don't understand what's happening here. It opens with like a POV shot, but then that's what's revealed. I guess like his first victim's like this hooker on the street, like that gets like dumped out of a car, and then just like he comes like when the visual of seeing a diver come out of the water of a canal and then stab her to death. You're like, what am I watching?
But it has one of the greatest body reveals ever, right at the start of that movie. It's one of my favorite scenes I've ever
Rob
seen.
Rob put it up online. It's brilliant.
I was so excited. I shared it in our Shockwaves group and on Twitter and stuff. But literally just 15 seconds of it
just
was
amazing.
So amazingly directed, where basically this body is hanging and then a tour boat goes like through it.
Yeah. With the glass ceiling.
God. The glass ceiling.
It's
so her body
gag.
Is just, so it's really great. And the whole movie delivers. I really love the characters and some of the kills. And then even the reveal was just so batshit that I was like, this movie, this is a gem. So kudos to you, Blue Underground. You guys have to see this one. Tons of extra features on it. It's also, I don't know if you got to see a dubbed version or what, but I watched the original Dutch.
I think it was a dubbed version.
I watched it with the original Dutch dialogue and subtitles.
Cool.
And I mean, it looks fantastic. Also, very rare that you see in the third act a fucking boat chase, like two boats, like literally the cop.
It's like this one and Striking Distance, and that's all.
Yeah, that's true. I like Striking Distance.
I love Striking
It's a very long. The killer and the cop are having this giant boat chase through the canals, and it's just pretty. It's just spectacular.
Police Academy 5 has a boat chase.
It's got nothing on Amsterdam.
It does not have anything on
Dick Amsterdam. Dick Moss didn't make it.
Yeah. No, exactly. So DM this gets my strongest recommendation. Right, cool. Amsterdam is wonderful.
I will watch it again on Blue for sure.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
My last one for the night is 1990, The Bronx Warrior, which was made in 1982. So he really only gave 8 years for the world to go to shit. The guy who, and I'm going to chew on his name here, Enzo Castellari, directed this. And so I've always loved the Bronx Warrior films. And so I'm now going to go back tonight and watch the second one.
Yeah,
and
these were all put out by Blue Underground as well.
And I picked these up at a recent convention where they were set up at. And yeah, I'm super psyched to rewatch these. These were Warrior ripoffs, where they have like little factions of interesting gangs. Like in this one, if you remember correctly, in Warriors, they had like the baseball players and the mimes.
Yeah.
And this one, they have a tap dancing gang. There is their gang, which is all bikers. And then they also have one that I thought was lepers. I think they call themselves the Scavengers, but they have like shit stuck to their faces and they're wearing rags. I was like, oh, they're the lepers. And then their rival gang are these roller skating guys in these like crazy like disco pads, but they're called the Zombies for some reason. And it's got this plot of this girl who is supposed to inherit this ammunition company is like running away, and she runs to the Bronx, which is called No Man's Land by 1990. Like the whole thing, it's lawless. It's crazy. And the guy who plays the head of the biker gang is this guy named Trash. And he is this Italian hunk with incredibly long arms. And
Mark Gregory, he's got like a baby face.
Yeah, he's got this like pouty lips and like a chiseled chest and this like crazy hair metal hair. And he takes her under his wing. And then there's this other gang headed by Fred Williamson.
Yes. Really?
Yeah. No, it's crazy.
They have the most awesome cars in the movie. Actually, most of the movie is your pretty standard kind of city siege. I'll even say it functions like a rape revenge movie where the rival gang kidnaps the girl. And then the Trash in his gang has to go get her. And then in the meantime, like one of his gang betrays him and goes off to one of the other gangs and tries to like, you know, tell him where he'll be so they can kill Trash. And anyway, so it functions very much like a revenge film. But the best scene in the movie by far is within the couple of minutes, there's this guy playing this drum solo on this pier. And he has like a full drum kit and he's just sitting on this pier outside of the Bronx playing this amazing drum solo. And then it pans over and there's this body on a spike next to him. And then the whole gang pulls up. And then Fred Williamson's gang pulls up and they have rival gang banter back and forth while this drum solo continues through the whole fucking
scene. It's crazy.
It's amazing.
It's basically the Warriors is the main one, but it's an Italian knockoff of the Warriors part, a little Escape from New York kind of, because it takes place in an apocalyptic New York.
Yeah.
Maybe Road Warrior too. They're basically pulling from all those.
There was a whole subgrouping of films that came out that were about like, you know, you can't fight your way through Bronx. It's the worst place on earth. Like Tenement was in there. Uh-huh. But yeah, this one is definitely a gem of the collection. So check out The Bronx Warrior. And I'm going to watch. 1990. The follow-up is Bronx Warrior 2000, which I will be watching tonight and reporting on next week.
Well, yeah, it's technically a trilogy, but not really. From what I hear, the sequel is Escape from the Bronx, which is the one that Blue Underground put out. And then the third one that's not really connected, but it was released at the same time, is called The New Barbarians. Those are technically it's only two movies, but they tack on that third one as if it's supposed to be kind of part of a trilogy.
I'll stand on point.
I researched. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to stand on point with the New York film, but you know, finish it.
I was going to quickly say that I researched the lead, the good looking baby face with the long arms. He now lives in Italy. He doesn't like to be contacted for interviews. And from what I could tell, he's like a life coach now. His bio was something like, I help people improve their lives. So I'm just going to say life coach.
Nice. All right.
Good for him.
Yeah.
My New York film that has been sitting on my shelf since Texas Frightmare, I've been dying to see it on Blu-ray. I got to see Brain Damage.
Nice.
Yes.
I got to watch Arrow. And it was really glorious to see it like this because that's a movie I've only seen dark, you know, on a VHS. And it's such a creative funny, strange little movie that it's one of those movies that when you watch it, you're like, it's hard to believe some guy made this movie. Mm. Like, it's just from his imagination, came up with these weird ideas and this creature, and somehow it works. It's one of those movies that probably shouldn't work at all. Like, it should, like Basket Case makes more sense to me in some ways why that works. Mm-hmm. This one, I feel like, should just totally fall apart. I haven't gotten through the extras yet, but I really enjoyed watching it. It looks just so great. The trippy sequences with the water and stuff just look just incredible. And it doesn't look bad. Like, it doesn't, I was worried it might ruin Almer, and it doesn't. It actually really and kind of improves his color and everything. It's a pretty remarkable. So I'm not going to go too in depth on that one because I feel like most of you know about Brain Dem.
Yeah.
I did see and the other one we were double featuring, and I'd never seen this film. You guys probably have Trick or Treats, the one about the little boy being babysat on Halloween and he's a magician.
No. Trick or Treats, but this is the one I think like Code Red maybe put this
Code
out.
Code Red put this out.
I have not seen this.
The Dick Grinert is a big fan of this one and
Trick or Treats.
Trick or Treats. It's
not Sammy Kerr, 80s. Not Sam Hain.
No. Trick or Treats. It's not the one with the heavy metal.
That's
it's not
Sammy Kerr.
Yeah. This one you know, Halloween completists absolutely should watch it. I put it above Haunted Ween. For sure.
Wow. Okay.
I just found it kind of redundant. David Carradine is in it for one scene at the start, and he's really kind of fun and charismatic at the start. He's a magician, and they're going away to Vegas, and their son is going to be left at home with a babysitter. But it's a really strange movie, and you could tell that it was made like as a true indie. By the kind of the family who are put, I think it's Gary Graver,
yes.
Who was the last guy to shoot an Orson Welles movie. He was like the last DP to work with Welles late in Welles' life. And I would watch this movie happily again on Halloween because I love movies set at Halloween, and it's got a couple really cool sequences. But it's also one of those movies where, oh, the guy's getting out of the insane asylum and he's going to try to make it home to torment you. And there's no real scares in this movie, but it's kind of some fun magic gags with the kid pretending he's dead. But they also outstay their welcome real quick. There's a lot of kind of obnoxious acting, but I could also imagine that this, and I'm sure, I don't even have to probably even say this a lot, I bet you in our Shockwaves group alone, there are probably people who this is literally their favorite movie. Like, this, it has that kind of quality. Quality where you're going to be someone who loves this movie because of nostalgia or when you saw it. But just seeing it in the context I saw it, I was kind of like, I was a little bored and a little unmoved by it. But because Halloween movies there just aren't enough of them set on Halloween, I say it's totally worth it on that level. See it for yourself. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the Code Red DVD Brulé is still around.
I was going to say,
you got to say Brulé.
The Brulé.
You always got to say Brulé. But, you know, for completists, and write to me to tell me I'm an idiot because you love this movie, because I bet you do, somebody out there. But, you know, I could have used more Gene Simmons for me.
Yeah, last I checked, I think it was – no, it's not on there anymore. It was available through Screen Archives, which usually carries a lot of the Code Red stuff. But if you hunt around, you'll probably find it.
So. But, you know, it's somebody's favorite movie.
Yeah. Just no, I want to see today. That one. I'm going to save it for
Save Halloween. It for Halloween, for sure. I think I would rewatch it again.
Anything else, Becca?
I watched this one. So after – everyone knows that I love those movies where they stuff everybody in one room and then they have to figure out why they're there. So I did a round at Trivia last month.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Which it was awesome.
Terrible round.
It was called All of These People Are in One Room Figuring Out Why They're There.
Except she put a still of everyone of this one group out in a forest and all the rest were in rooms.
That's
and
because
so all of us were like, oh, it must be – what was that one? Severance or something, because it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was something that no one
ever – that one was My Little Eye, which was the group of people traveling to the one.
We talked about on the show.
On the show. You should know that.
So frustrating.
But anyway, so after that, somebody was like, "You should check out this film that's on Netflix called Circle from 2015, which is a whole bunch of people in one room and this weird device in the middle that's killing one of them every couple of minutes, and they have to figure out why or how to stop it." And it was not my cup of tea. But, you know, it's still – I was waiting for a really big twist. And I will say that they did go some interesting places in the way that they were kind of trying to shape it. But it was not as smart as I would say. If you would like these movies, and a lot of them did kind of come post-Saw, where they do just put five people in a room and make them figure out why they're there.
Mm-hmm.
Nine Dead is a really good one. Fermat's Room I really liked. And I would also say The Killing Room's really good. So,
if you like movies, sit in one room. You know what I did see before Annabelle 2?
That predates Saw.
They showed the Saw trailer, which I hadn't seen.
Oh, the new Saw trailer, yeah.
And me and Dick both looked at each other and go, I'm in.
Yeah.
I was kind of surprised, man.
I was really skeptical that I finally saw it. And well, I was like, okay,
like a,
I'm in.
It looked like a real movie.
Yeah.
And the rest of the, like a lot of the sequels towards the end didn't stop looking. They looked like Saw movies, not real movies. This looked like a real movie. So even if it's not good, it looked fun.
Yeah, at least the scope of it looks kind of fun.
Before
yeah.
before we leave, though, I didn't even tell. I'm just got to at least say this. Why I reference it's got, why it's got a Kathy's curse.
Oh yeah. What? God.
There's literally a shot, and this isn't really a spoiler because it's pretty early in the movie. In Annabelle 2, where a girl is holding a portrait of a little girl who used to live there, and she goes, holds it into darkness, and the eyes glow in the exact same way it happens in Kathy's Curse.
Wow.
And so if David has seen Kathy's Curse, he's a living legend. And if he's not, he just unintentionally referenced one of the worst films ever made.
No,
so either way,
sure.
Kudos to you, David.
That's pretty amazing. Alrighty, we are going to take a quick break and then bring our guests on. We got some pretty amazing guests from AFCA.
Yeah, AGFA,
which,
yeah.
Is that how
I guess so,
right?
AGFA, yeah. American Genre nice. Film.
Well, listen, the Zodiac Killer is on Blu-ray because of these people. So we'll
all
get to
site.
It. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates?
With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard.
Find out today why ZipRecruiter is being used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/shock. That's ZipRecruiter.com/shock. One more time, try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/shock. We are back, and we are being joined by a pair of genuine cinephiles, Joseph Ziemba and Brett Berg, who, flashback, Brett Berg was on an episode of Killer POV way back when we did United States of Horror.
Yeah, the 50 States of Horror.
50 States of Horror, with Cine Family. So they are joining us about a lot of things, but specifically something that I got really excited when I first heard about it a couple years, or maybe it was about a year and a bit ago, I think, when somebody gave me a shirt, AGFA, which is the American Genre Film Archives. So they're going to tell us a little about that to continue our exploitation love. So welcome, guys.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
How did this happen? To paraphrase
broad, Rob. Broad question.
He just goes right to the punch. What happened here? How did this happen?
Let's talk about what it is initially and where it came from, because a lot of people will be familiar with things like Alamo Drafthouse.
Yeah.
But beyond that, they might not know.
So what's an AGFA?
AGFA is the American Genre Film Archive. It's a nonprofit sister company of the Alamo Drafthouse that Alamo CEO Tim League started in 2009. And the reason why it started is he heard about a bunch of genre film prints that were being sold down south. Mm-hmm. And he thought, well, there's about 400 of those. I can get a U-Haul and I can go buy those and I can bring them back to Austin and then I'll have all these prints. And he did that all by himself. But when he got back, he had no idea what to do with them. Huh. And so he and Carrie League, which is his wife, decided to start the American Genre Film Archive, which is a nonprofit. And basically to house these prints and to have a place for them so that they'd be available to people for bookings everywhere, all across the world.
Do we know where these prints came from, this collection?
It's somewhere down south. I don't know exactly where it was. Sebastian
would
know.
Was it like a dude or like a...
It was a dude. Like,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a dude in a warehouse.
That's what I always hear tell of these. Like, you know, so-and-so is having found, you know, 20 reels from these 1970s films that you've never seen at like a warehouse sale in Canada and things
allegedly
like that.
Allegedly, it was Colonel Sanders. We don't know. but it's a good image to have in your head.
Dude down south. Clearly Colonel Sanders.
My great aunt dated Colonel Sanders.
What?
Whoa. Yeah. Look at that.
The real one?
Yeah, the real
Did
one.
Did he wear that little like stringy tie all the time?
I actually have family photos of him holding me when I was a kid and he was hanging out. Yeah,
that's probably the best revelation
of
this.
Pretty good, right?
That's up there with our poltergeist story.
tell me the star, and I'm not sure if it's part of the AGFA, but I remember seeing the astrologer, the astrologer, which was one of the craziest things I've seen on a screen. Like, pretty kind of amazing, and I know it came about kind of from a similar place, right? But didn't the film print there get discovered in the Sex Institute of the guys who did the, or is that not the case?
Becca just perked up.
Yeah, you know, the Sex Institute, there's actually a place in New York called, that's the Sex Museum. There's a Sex Museum in
New York. Hard to tell because we have so much at AGFA. So that one was basically found in the archive, like deep in the bowels of the archive. And that kind of led us onto the path of where AGFA is today by finding a movie like that, whereas we have all of these prints and people are enjoying them and they're renting them and they're playing in front of audiences, which is where they should be.
Right.
But what can we do with AGFA that would make, what can we do, what's more that we can do, like what can we do for the cause that's going to make these movies more available? And so about a year and a half ago, Sebastian Del Castillo, who is the head archivist at AGFA, and I had this idea where what if AGFA became something bigger, not just having the prints, but what if it became an actual theatrical and home video distribution label? And so we went to Tim with that, and he liked the idea, and so we started doing that. And then so that's kicking off like right now, actually. And then we also have a new theatrical distribution arm of AGFA, which is handling a lot of libraries, including AGFA, and then our friends at Severn and Vinegar Syndrome and Arrow Films. And that's how Brett came to be working with AGFA, because Brett is the theatrical sales manager of AGFA. And he is a wizard. He's the best at what he does. Amazing.
And used to program, so back on our old show, used to program for CineFamily, and before that was a Cinephile employee. And
yeah, I was one of the original employees of Cinephile Video, which is next door to the New Art in Santa Monica.
One of the best video stores around. So through going through this, you have to have, I mean, I can't imagine going through the amount of films you probably have to go watch or look through to find gems. So you obviously, I have to assume you both have, I mean, we've spoken before, but a deep passion for movies and also just like offbeat movies. You know, a big part of what we haven't revealed yet, brace yourselves, is that he was also the co-writer of Bleeding Skull. Now everyone's going fucking batshit at home because they know that, because we talked about that like 5 years ago too.
But that's awesome. Like, I told him when he came in, I'm like, I know everything you have ever written for Bleeding Skull, but you're going to have to fill me in on your draft house position.
Thank you.
So yeah.
So like, talk about like where your passion for like these kind of movies came from. The kind of offbeat, necessarily.
Were you a video store kid like the rest of us?
Yeah, absolutely.
Either attending or working at one?
I never worked at one. Attending as far back as I could remember. I grew up in Chicago. And then in the suburb of Chicago Heights where we lived, there was a video store called The Video Store.
Oh,
and
original.
That was our family video store where we went to rent everything. Yeah, so I was very early on very much into these movies. And it just kind of like as I went, I discovered new directors and new, like it started with William Castle when I was a little kid. I remember one of my earliest memories was seeing 13 Ghosts with my dad. And like the lights went out in our house during a storm while we were watching it. And it was really like, oh, this is so amazing. I really loved it. And then I discovered in high school Ed Wood. And that was a big turning point for me. And then as the years went on, it was Doris Wishman and Herschel Gordon Lewis. And then even later, Chester Turner, Mark and John Polonia. Like, it just kept going and going and going. And so it's just a lifelong love and appreciation. And the reason why I started Bleeding Skull in 2004 was because this love that I had, I felt that wasn't being shared throughout the world. I felt people were talking down to these movies, making fun of them. They're picking on the fat kid, which we all know what that feels like because we were all that kid at some point in our lives. And so that is something that was always really important to me, that these movies were elevated and they were appreciated in the same light that movies by Altman or Godard were appreciated by certain people. So that was always really important for me, but at the same time, having fun in my appreciation of these movies. So that's where it all came from.
Well, it's funny because when obviously we're all of the video store generation, and I think what happens is you find the franchises and the well-known things that you read in Fangoria, and then you try, and then like you're on a quest. You want to find the one that nobody's ever seen before that you could tell all your friends about. And what's fun about Bleeding Skull, I mean, we did an episode with Dan Budnick and for Killer POV, our previous show.
Which is great.
Yeah, and of all the episodes we did, you know, I like to think that our collective knowledge is pretty good. We didn't know a single title that Dan threw out.
I left with a list.
We were like, wow.
Because I think we did something similar than what we're going to do tonight, where you were supposed to bring a list of lesser known films. And I mean, like, I'm getting like, okay, well, I think pretty sure like me and four other people have seen this one. The stuff that Dan brought, I was like, I don't even know where to find this stuff. And you can't. And yeah, it was amazing, his knowledge
but
of
you
these.
But you can,
like,
read about them.
You can read about all of them. You can read about them.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, is there a specific, not, I don't want to say subgenre, but a specific thing that you loved sharing with people? Like, for example, a lot of this is shot on video stuff, which is very... very obscure unless you rented it when it came out. Mm-hmm. So do you have a preference for some of the stuff that's been on Bleeding Skull personally?
I have a preference for the movies that are very individualistic, and that the ones that are the more lo-fi and out there and strange that they are, the ones that feel like they're from somebody's heart in a way that they had to do it. And that's, they had to do it because that was their life. Like, I have to make this movie. I can't do anything else. Like, I can't bag groceries. I can't be a librarian. I can't be a mechanic. I have to make this movie. And that's what attracts me the most, because I think the most interesting stories come from that, from people's creativity. Because I feel like when people have unleashed that in their mind, when they have, there's nothing holding them back. Like, there's no one else with money. There's no one telling them what to do. That's when the most interesting things come out, because there's no filter and it just goes. And the great thing about the era of Super 8 and shot on video in the 80s and 90s is that there was more of that because it was possible. It was easy for people because, I mean, you could go to a video store like Chester Turner did and have a trunk full of Tales of the Quad Dud Zone or Black Devil Doll from Hell, and you could sell them to video stores, and they'd put them up next to Halloween, and people wouldn't know the difference.
Right.
Because they're like, the cover art looks great. This looks amazing. I think I'll rent it. And they'd get home and be like, what did I just do? You know, what happened? So that's what I'm most attracted to. And I think that's what fuels Bleeding Skull and AGFA to a certain degree, because it kind of lines up perfectly, because AGFA was always about championing the obscure movies. So they fit together very well.
Well, you know, I also miss the commitment to renting a movie like you know, Tales of the Quad Zone, because it's like, now you can stream through 800 different things. You can watch 5 minutes of it and be like, I don't like this. I'm not going to watch it. But you went out to the video store, you paid money, you take home this thing, and no matter what, you're like, well, this is the night's plan.
It's
we're going to watch this.
There's some sort of contract being bound there.
Yeah,
it's true.
And usually, by the time you get to the end of it, there's something. There's something that appeals to the money, the movie lover in you.
Yeah.
Right? And for the longest time, I thought that my no longer being willing to watch things the whole way through, because now if something's on Netflix and I started and suddenly like it's got crappy sound quality or the production value is bad, I'll turn it off and find something else. For the longest time, I thought that that was because I was getting older and that I was just like, I don't have time for this type of stuff anymore. And I think that that's actually not a generational thing now. I think that that's a lot. I think most people do that regardless of their age now. But yeah, when it was on video, you know, it was all I had that night. It was this, or I'm going to have to go pull old home movies and watch. So yeah, I'm going to watch it no matter how bad it is.
And there's a sense of comfort in that, because they become your friends. These movies become your special friends that you can watch over and over and over. If you feel down, it's like, oh, you could go watch something uplifting, like, I don't know, like City Lights by Charlie Chaplin, or you could watch, I don't know, Bad Taste. And that makes you feel just as good because it's your movie. And it's something. So I think there's something really special in that, especially when you're talking about growing up with video stores. I mean, that's a huge part of it.
Or even the movies on TV, I discover I did the same thing, because like USA Up All Night, I used to watch Night Flight all the time. Mm-hmm. Or they used to have this Kung Fu thing on Sunday mornings, Kung Fu Theater on Sunday mornings where I grew up. And it was like, well, you could watch this, some kung fu movie that's probably not so great, but you know, you could watch this, or you could go watch Cartoon Express on USA. And so I always opted for the kung fu movie. And it was like a commitment. I had to see it through to the end.
Before we delve into some of the stuff that you guys have been doing recently, I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit about launching Bleeding Skull as a website, you know, creating this thing. Because when did it exactly launch, and what was like the web landscape like, and that you were like, this is what's going to set us different from all the other horror sites?
Oh, I had no idea what I was doing. It was purely based on my love of the movie. So it launched on January 1st, 2004. And what happened is I was in a band at the time, and I was on tour and gathering all these movies at video stores, because at that time, like 2002, 2003 was the golden age of finding video stores that were liquidating their stocks. It was like $1.50 a tape. So I was like filling the van with tapes, and then I'd come home and watch them all. And at the time I was a freelance designer. So I was like, I need a new website for my design work. So, and I saw this ad in the back of a comic for Bleeding Skull, which is like you light the candle and the skull bleeds. And I thought that's a great name for a design company. I'm going to do that. And I started making this portfolio site, and I lost interest immediately. I was like, this is dumb. I don't like it. So I thought, I think one day I was, our band played a show like the night before Thanksgiving and I got really sick. I got the flu afterwards. And so the next day at Thanksgiving, I missed Thanksgiving. So I wasn't able to go hang out with my family. And so I was sitting on the couch and thinking like, oh, what can I do? I think I'll watch Shriek of the Mutilated and write a review of it because it sounds like fun. And so in this total daze of feverish flu, I wrote a review of that movie and I thought it was really fun. So I decided to just start a site and start putting them up. And that was it. I didn't think about it at all. And my friend at the time, RJ, had his own server. So he was like, I'll host this for you because at the time to get a .com was so expensive. And it was like uphill battle. So yeah, it was a good time. I had fun doing it. You know, that's why I did it.
Did you ever do writing before that? Or was that kind of the first?
Never. Wow. Yeah, I did. I did stuff in college. I took some creative writing classes in college, you know, because I didn't want to take philosophy courses or geography courses. So I did stuff like that. And when I was a kid, I wrote comics on my own. Like I did like Cracked magazine ripoffs and, you know, stuff like that. But never any serious. I still don't consider myself a writer. I would never think that I'm a writer. Like I write. It's just something fun that I do that I like to share. So.
Did you ever get to a point in the website where, like, obviously you love to watch movies, but where you felt obligated to watch as much as humanly possible for the sake of the website? Because, for example, our friend Brian Collins did Horror Movie a Day for 2,500 days.
When it becomes a chore.
That's a lot of days.
He's like, it came a point where he's like, oh, my God, I would have never watched this, but I need to hit that quota for the day. So... Did you ever get to that point?
I think that's a really good question because right now, Zach Carlson, Annie Choi, and I are working on the second Bleeding Skull book, which is Bleeding Skull, a 1990s trash horror odyssey.
Ooh, boy.
So we each have about, I don't know, 85 to 100 reviews to do. And there have been many moments where it's like, I can't believe, like you get, and most of these movies, like none of us have heard, either, like the three of us were like, this is new uncharted territory for us. And there have definitely been moments where it's like, I don't know if I can watch three more Todd Sheets movies. I love Todd Sheets, but I'm not sure if I can make it. But then I do. So it's like that's I think one of the only times. And usually on the site, if it gets like feeling like that, I kind of like take a break or like Annie will write a review or Zach will do a review and balances out. But not generally. People have asked me that at work. Like, do you ever get sick of like the Bleeding Skull movies? And I never ever do. I've never once ever been sick of it. I took a break for like 2 years because like life stuff. Like I got divorced and I'm like I can't watch horror movies anymore because they're a bad influence and I need to watch things that are happier. And that was a big mistake. So I'm never gonna do that.
I went through that right after I had kids where I was suddenly like I really shouldn't be watching these as much. I'll limit it to just work stuff and then immediately like I'm just like but it's what I want to watch.
It's what I love.
Am I doing this to myself? I'm not rom-coms.
It's in my DNA, so I have to do it and I love it. So
how'd you find, like, especially when you're talking about the 90s ones, how do you even find them or find out about the titles that you would that you don't know about? So how does one find, is it chat rooms or what kind of search are you doing?
So for the 90s stuff, it's been a combination of what Zach and I already had in our collections and then going from there, reaching out to other collectors, friends. But Zach Carlson is probably the second greatest VHS collection I've ever seen in my life, of all the people that I've met. It's really intense. Yeah. I mean, the amount of depth that he has in his collection. So a lot of it came from Zach's initial, you know, mountain of knowledge and tapes and then mine. And from there, it was actually going back to old print zines from the 80s and 90s and looking at the ads and looking at what was reviewed. A lot of the stuff's not on the internet yet. But with Letterboxd, that's changing a lot because pretty much everything is starting to be on there. But when we started researching the book about 2 years ago, it was all through Alternative Cinema Magazine, Draculina Magazine, like buying old issues, Psychotronics, like buying all of those and just like noting everything that was in there and trying to find it all and reaching out to directors that directed the movies and seeing if they had copies, like of stuff that we couldn't find. But there's still a list of about like 15 that we haven't been able to find that we're just like, oh, we gotta get it, but it's not gonna happen. But yeah.
Have you discovered any, like, and when I mean gems, I mean like, yeah, that's, you know, some people, like things. I always champion things to people. But then,
yes.
But it's one of my favorites. Yes. But then often people, the reaction I get sometimes when they watch it is not what I had, the experience I had watching things was just like magic. But then somebody will watch and go, what the hell? You never know if it's going to connect. But have you discovered ones in this 90s phase that you're doing where you're like, holy shit, how does somebody not know about this?
Have you found a couple of those? Any total gems that you're just like, how has this not been seen by everyone?
Yes.
What are some?
Any chance I get, I like to talk about Mark and John Polonia, who are, extreme DIY filmmakers who started with Splatter Farm in 1987. That was their first movie, and they made it when they were 16 years old.
Wow.
What are their names again?
Shit. Mark and John Polonia. So Mark and John Polonia started out making Super 8 movies in high school, and they graduated very quickly when their parents got a camcorder, I think, for Christmas, and they made this movie called Splatter Farm. And Splatter Farm to this day is one of the most extreme like experiences of like sludge shot on video. Like it's incredible and it's affecting. It is like dark and hilarious and it goes way too far. Like they're twin brothers who are, the thing that I love about them is that they're always themselves, always. Like you get the feeling that it was like, everyone was telling them like, why are you guys doing this? But they were like, no, this is what we want to do. We love making horror movies. We love horror movies. So they just did it no matter what. And that's the thing that I really love about them, because they're very true to themselves and following their dreams. But yeah, Splatter Farm is an experience that you'll never, ever forget.
Did they
make
others after that?
They're still making stuff. These guys have like literally dozens of films. Pralien sounds, Alien Predators, Pralien.
That's the house that screamed. That's a good
that's
title.
The one that I think I may have seen. That one's from 2000.
Yeah,
that looks vaguely familiar. But yeah,
it's weird that
got
these movies
tons.
Still exist post 2000 though. I feel like there's something about 70s, 80s, 90s. Anything after that, it's like really, it's still happening. But I guess that will be the third book.
Think about it when you go to conventions in other, like not LA or New York, you always see the local filmmakers set up. Like when we go to Texas, I'm always excited to see like some of the filmmakers that are set up there that are only based there. Like, but I always meet and find really cool stuff. Like I found Billy Pond that way.
Hmm. And you're writing I've heard a big book of just all about Woodchipper Massacre, right?
I think that could be done.
I think it could be
a long form 200-page interview with John McBride.
Oh,
the world needs it.
I think a TV show.
That's my all-time favorite family. I think every Thanksgiving I basically post a photo of that family, because there's something about that family that just looks so bizarre to me.
That kid is the best air guitar ever in that movie.
Would a title like that be in your Bleeding Skull? Or
Woodchipper Massacre is in the first book.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah,
it had to be. Mm-hmm. That's a no-brainer.
That one. Now, does it ever bother you to watch SOV? Because I, as much as I appreciate it now, when I try to watch SOV stuff, I'm kind of like, this is a bit taxing on the eyes. Do you have that problem? Or does
you mean newer shot on video stuff, or even in
old,
the 80s?
Like in the 80s. Like there's some 80s. That I say that they covered it well. Like some of the ones that we've watched, I'm like, it's tolerant. But then other ones, I'm like, okay, the visuals are on this are kind of giving me a headache.
Yeah, I think it depends on your personal tolerance for that stuff. It's the same thing with like a movie like Wreck. You know, if someone watches a movie like Wreck and they're like, this is making me sick, I can't watch more than 5 minutes of this. But for someone else, like, oh, I love it. It's like being on a roller coaster. So I think it just depends on your personal, like, aesthetic, like what you like. Because for me, the shot on video is really appealing because it's very urgent. Mm-hmm. It's another thing I was saying about how it's these people have the most interesting stories when it's about them, basically. And you can't get more interesting than home movies to me, and like figuring out these people's stories and why are they doing this. And so I really like that aesthetic of shot on video. It's just very urgent and very real to me.
It's very erratic. Like that's the one thing, because, and I guess it is a lot of the technology where it is mostly shoulder held and there is no kind of motion control on it. So every single time I watch it, it's like worse than found footage for me, where I always leave kind of feeling like I'm little nauseous on
this
one.
I could see that for sure.
Not but all then, of them, though. Like Sledgehammer?
No.
Well, no.
Yeah.
Not
some
all of them.
Some of them are pure magic, though.
Yeah, some of them are absolutely amazing, I do have to say.
Regarding Bleeding Skull, you mentioned there's going to be a second book coming out. What about the first book? Because I know a lot of people have been searching for at least a paperback edition of it, and it's very hard to get and very expensive. With the new book coming out, is there a possibility of a reprint of the original, or what's the status with that?
I would say probably not. I don't think there is. I think for me personally, I think the new book was a sign of what we were doing at a time, and it's a representation and a document of that era of Bleeding Skull.
Right.
And now Bleeding Skull is what it is now. So I just always, it's something with me. I just prefer to keep moving forward. I just like doing more, like doing more new stuff. So probably not, I would say.
All right. And how far along are you on Bleeding Skull 2, the second volume?
We're pretty far along, actually. It's going to be released by Fantagraphics in 2018. And our deadline for the manuscript is in March. So our internal deadline for being done with the writing is December. And then Annie is going to edit the whole thing. So we're pretty close. Annie has like 6 reviews left, and we all started with like 85.
Oh, my God.
So she's really close. I have 12 left, and Zach has a few more. than us, but we're getting close. Yeah.
All right. Well, to listeners, don't snooze or you'll miss out on this one too.
Are there any films, like in terms of your tolerance when you're watching that volume of these kinds? Mm-hmm. Like we're talking about gems, and you don't even have to name titles because we're not a hating on cinema show, as we told you before. But are there some where even now you're just physically tested to get through it?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Okay. There's some that are just... You know, you can tell that there was a lot of heart in the person that's trying to make something, like get something done, but you can only go so far when you're making, you know, a slasher movie that's set in a haunted house that has no script and all of your friends in it, and you got to fill up 70 minutes, and it's like, there's nothing. It's like, I'm trying to look for something, and there's nothing here. It's like, it's pretty taxing, but, you know, those are few and far between. There's not that many that are just like, oh God, like I'm going to die. I'm going to put my head in the I can't do it. So if for the most part, they get by a lot on their heart. You know, it's like, you can always tell that like there's so much going into it. So you kind of feel like empathy while you're watching the movie.
Let's talk about some of the ACFA titles.
I got to bring up Zodiac Killer because, all right, so I missed this when it was on a double DVD or a DVD double feature with Something Weird. I remember the title and I remember seeing it. But what happened was I went to my friend Scott's house one night and I guess he DVR'd it off of Turner Classics.
Yeah, Sam, that's right.
And literally he's like, dude, I watched like 5 minutes of this and then stopped it and knew I had to wait for you to get here. He's like, I cannot experience this alone and I feel like you're the one that's going to appreciate it. And I mean, and obviously it was probably the restoration that you guys did because it looked amazing.
Oh, thanks.
For what it was. And we were like, I think I talked about it on the show. I was pretty speechless by this movie. I didn't, there was so much about it. I also love Fincher's Zodiac. It's like my favorite Fincher movie. Yeah. So to have those two movies, I was kind of like, wow. And then I realized that this was going to be part of a Blu-ray release. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Zodiac Killer. When did you guys discover this movie? Because one of the most exciting things was after the fact, reading about it and then finding out, oh, this was actually made in an attempt to capture the Zodiac Killer. So when did you guys stumble on this one?
For me, it was early 2000s. It was a Something Weird VHS. They had first put it out. And that was at the time when I discovered Something Weird towards the late 90s when I went to college. And they had that was like a newer one that they put out. They put it on VHS and then that triple feature DVD came out. And that's how I discovered it. And with Something Weird, it's more about the brand of Something Weird rather than the individual titles. It's like I will watch at the time, you know, it's like anything with the Something Weird logo, I'm going to watch it, you know, even if it just ends up being an hour of people go-go dancing naked. Like, I will watch it.
I've seen that one.
I know.
I really have. There's many.
Yeah, yeah.
There used to be a VOD channel. That they had a Something Weird VOD channel when I lived in New York City. Mm-hmm. And it was literally just like, sometimes they would have movies on there, like you would watch full stuff like Queen of a Thousand Nights or stuff like that. And then other times it would just be reels and loops of like people go-go dancing. And then they take a top off and then it would end. And then another one
would
start.
We need more channels like that.
It was a great
That's so much better than Netflix. Like, I just don't. I love that idea.
So I discovered that movie, and that was one of the ones like Dracula the Dirty Old Man or Double Agent 73, where the ones from.
That's a Wishman.
Yeah, it is. It was one of the top tier Something Weirds. It was for me, it was like, this is a classic Something Weird title. So when Mike Vranney unfortunately passed away in 2014, at the time, it was kind of unsure what was going to happen with Something Weird in the archive. And Lisa Petrucci, who is now the president of Something Weird, at the time we started talking with her about, you know, we are a nonprofit, we're AGFA, we would love to help. We did like a marathon in memoriam for Mike in Austin at the Alamo. And it just kind of, we started talking more after that. And that's the way like the partnership kind of worked out and AGFA and Something Weird. And when we got the initial list from Lisa of the movies that were available to re-release together, all I was thinking was like, please let Zodiac Killer be on the list. Like, please let it be there. And then I went to the bottom of the spreadsheet right away and it was there. And I was so happy, so happy. So that's how we ended up making that the initial release for AGFA and Something Weird.
So tell people, I mean, Rob knows because he had to write about this, but tell people a little about what was happening behind the scenes of Zodiac Killer. Because I started on TCM before I'd heard your announcement, so I didn't know there was any, like, there's no hoopla about why this is a special film. I just recorded TCM because I was like, oh, Zodiac Killer, that sounds crazy. And so I'm watching it kind of speechless, especially about the wig, the one wig, the guys, it's kind of an amazing toupee. But like the stories behind it just add this whole other layer to what you're watching. So can you just talk a little bit about what you guys discovered through, I don't know, researching it?
Yeah, absolutely. Mostly it all came from Tom Hansen, the director, who we tracked down because of Chris Pagiali with Temple of Schlock, who had tracked him down before. But The thing that's insane about Zodiac Killer is that I think when most of us find ourselves in a position where our community is threatened by someone who is killing people, you know, is on the rampage, we'd probably just close our doors and watch the news and make sure that our family is safe. But in the case of Tom Hansen, he took it 20 steps further and said, you know what? This guy's a threat to everyone around here. I'm going to catch this son of a bitch. And the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to make a movie so that when I show the movie, he comes to the movie because he's such a fame whore. And then we will jump this guy and catch him.
So that was his whole intention of making the movie, was just to lure this guy
to
the movie.
Yeah, and he wanted to make $1 million off of it so he could make more movies. So it was pure business. No art whatsoever involved in the Zodiac Killers.
Okay, so did it work?
He thinks it did. He says that it did. I don't know. I mean, I can't say. I mean, obviously no one ever found out who the Zodiac Killer was, so maybe he's still out there.
I bet you he came. I bet his intention is correct. I bet that no matter what, whoever that killer was, they definitely would have gone
to
that 100%.
Because the crazy thing about it is that it's the only movie in history that was made to catch a serial killer while the serial killer was still on the rampage. It's insane that someone thought that. And the fact that Tom Hansen was... he had a couple of walk-ons and he'd help friends make movies, but he owned Pizza Man restaurant, a chain of restaurants in Los Angeles.
That's what I was just reading. Yeah. I was like, it says here he owned pizza restaurants.
Yeah, it's insane. It's okay, so this guy who made all of his fortune from selling pizzas decides to make a movie about the Zodiac Killer to catch him. And the methods he used to catch him were completely wild.
This sounds like a great biopic.
I know.
You know what I mean? The behind the scenes of trying to make that. And then you have the real Zodiac just comes to the movie and then leaves and quietly, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember, it might have been Brett who mentioned to me that there was at one point a sting operation or something about handwriting. How did that, is this a true story or not?
Yeah. There's a couple of methods that they used to catch the Zodiac. And the first one was a guy named Manny Nedwick, who was a producer on the movie, had an in with Kawasaki Motorcycles. So they thought, you know, why don't you get a Kawasaki motorcycle and we'll raffle it off because that will attract the Zodiac because everybody wants a Kawasaki motorcycle, including the Zodiac. Everybody's got to get around. So let's get this going. So that didn't work. So the second one they had was completely insane, which was they had this empty meat locker, frozen freezer next to the box office, and it had air holes punctured in it. And there was a buzzer next to the box office, and they had everyone who came into the theater was given a card to write down a handwriting sample. And then they took the card, Tom Hansen would take the card. And if he thought that it looked anywhere near the Zodiac's handwriting, he would hit the buzzer. And he had three dudes in the freezer ready to jump out and grab the person at the box office. And the guys in the freezer were the guys who starred in the movie. So the guy you mentioned with the wig, Grover, Bob Jones, he was in the freezer.
I love that.
And so he was and he liked to fight. You know, he was let's get this guy, let's kill him.
I could tell from the performance that's just hung in there.
And Bob Jones is Bob Jones in that movie. He's playing himself, basically. So it was completely insane. And so they did find a guy that had handwriting that they thought matched him. So they grabbed this guy and pulled him into the bathroom and punched him a few times.
Oh.
And they're like, you know, it's him. And so it ended up maybe being him, maybe not being him. And the cool thing about it is that the thing I always defaulted to is, weren't you guys worried about attacking innocent people or worried about that the Zodiac was going to come after you?
Yeah.
And Tom Hansen was always like, no, I was packing a .38. What do I have to be scared of? It's amazing.
This is a movie.
It's so good.
This is a great,
and so they actually do think that could have, there was they were left thinking.
Did they turn him over to the police?
No, they didn't. But, and this is where it gets even crazier.
I love
for this. The next 15 years, Tom Hansen followed this guy.
God, this poor guy.
Stalked him for 15 years.
And he says to this day, we did a commentary with him for the Blu-ray. He's to this day, we're like, who is it? Tell us who it is. And he's nope, because I'm saving that for the FBI. He thinks that he really, truly thinks that he knows who the Zodiac is to this day. Huh. It's kind of amazing.
Wow.
That is a commentary I'll listen to.
Yeah.
And
you shot some on-camera stuff with him for the Blu-ray, too?
We did,
there are a lot of these stories all over the disc?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. He goes way in-depth on the commentary.
Okay, and what the hell? There's a bonus movie called Another Son of Sam from 1977 in a 2K scan?
Yes.
Explain this madness. What is this?
Okay, so Another Son of Sam has nothing to do with Son of Sam, let alone Another Son of Sam.
But it's a sequel to Spike Lee's classic film, right?
Obviously.
Classic Adrian Brody, yeah.
So this movie is basically a proto-slasher. It's a pretty straightforward mid-70s proto-slasher. It was made in the early 70s and not released till the late 70s because they wanted to... it was called Hostages first. And so when the Son of Sam came out, they're like, oh, we can re-release this movie with this new title card and no one will know the difference. So It's an absolutely, it's like almost three steps down from Zodiac in terms of someone making a movie that probably had never seen a movie or how they function. Like, how do you do this? Yeah. Because it has moments in the movie where it just breaks into like slow motion. Like, there'll be someone like, get over here, like get to the police station. And the cop comes in. And then right before he's about to open the door to the police station, it goes slow motion. Nice. And he opens and goes into the police. It's just complete madness. Yeah, like, yeah. Why would you do that? So it has a feeling of a lot of the movies, I think, that we're attracted to with Agfa, where it's like it is from a complete different dimension. It is a proto-slasher police procedural made by extraterrestrials that is beamed down here for us to enjoy. Yeah. And it's just a completely different world.
That is a great feeling when you watch one that is just so outside of what normal film language is. And especially because the Hollywood model is just so, like, you know, it's so well, even a bad Hollywood film still gets you emotionally because it just has this operating pattern. But when you watch something like Things, I remember when I first saw the opening of that is so radically different than the next 75 minutes. Mm-hmm. Like, and there's no connective tissue. And you're just like, there's a naked woman wearing a weird mask. Mm-hmm. And then something else happens. And then suddenly the movie becomes like a weird Evil Dead comedy or something. Thing.
I need to rewatch Things. You're like inspired it's by it. And I was just like,
Brett introduced me to Things.
Hell of a drug.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a nice little Canadian Fantasia. It's just like a little bloop, a little cherry.
Did you tell these guys your Thing story?
Oh, yeah. The Thing story was excellent.
I don't know how many. Well, Brett has listened to the occasional show on here, so he might have heard. Our listeners have heard it a million times, but. At Jump Cut.
It was worth repeating.
It is a good story.
I was there. I took a picture.
I've forgotten his name. What's Barry. So I ran this place called Jump Cut Cafe in the Valley, and we screened movies. And I would always pick something from my shelf to like pre-viz. It would usually be Possession just to like, so I'd look at it and test the thing. And the place wasn't even open. We were closed. And
what were you screening that night? Because wasn't it beta?
Oh, that's right. It was called Beta 8 or High 8.
High 8.
It was an anthology of all those guys. Like a lot of them had made shorts, people from the era that you're talking about.
And there was like three of us in there eating. And that
there was no one really there. And I basically, for no reason at all, I was just like walking out the door and I go, oh, you know what I should grab? I want to put Things on to watch the start of that and show like one of my like baristas so they'd see a little bit of Things. So I just grabbed it, just totally random off the shelf. I put it on and the title card comes up, right? And it's just saying Things. And I'm standing in an empty cafe and behind me, I turn around and Barry's standing there.
What?
Yes. And he looks at me and goes, is this some kind of joke? And I said, what do you mean? And he goes, that's Things. I'm Barry. That's my movie. And I said, what the fuck is going, like my whole brain, because he didn't have the mustache anymore.
But this isn't the killer part.
Oh yeah, there's more.
No, then it gets, it does have a good twist.
Well, what was he in town for?
He came for the American
Film Market.
Film Market.
First time in LA.
And he had just gotten to LA, which is nowhere near the Jump Cut. And he.
Yeah, it's Santa Monica versus Studio City.
He just saw that some people were showing that movie, this like new movie. And he goes, so I just came out here, but I can't believe it. You're showing my movie. And then I just started playing it. And like, we had, got a photo together. I go, this is like really might be the greatest moment ever. Just, like just in terms of cinema, like I beamed you here.
That's incredible.
I mean, he's had like Wes Craven and John Carpenter people. He's never been more excited somebody coming in a Jump Cut.
It didn't make sense.
Glowing.
I know. It's amazing.
And he was glowing even more. Like, and Barry will always now write to me in a way where he's, it's like we've known each other for 30 years. The way he, if he writes me on Facebook, it's like out of, just because of this one moment. But it gets really bizarre. So it's a very small place, kind of like this room. And there's like a couple couches and a bunch of chairs, and we screen this High 8 movie and the lights come on and everyone's doing a Q&A, and then the guy doing the Q&A looks over at one of the couches and goes, oh my god, and he goes, Barry, who made Things, is sitting next to the guy who made that other movie called Things in the 80s.
Oh, Dennis Devine.
They were sitting next to each other. I've never met and didn't
on
even know it.
On the front couch, like right in the front
just
row.
Just these two guys sitting together and everyone was, and they're like, oh, I've always wanted to meet you. And they're shaking hands.
Oh my God.
And because I remember that gag and I know you guys were in that documentary. There's two of them.
I think it's in Adjust Your Tracking.
Yeah, there's two of them. Adjust Your Tracking and I remember there's
Rewind
two.
Rewind this.
Rewind this.
But I think it's in Adjust Your Tracking where it's the multiple things.
Yeah. Where the one guy's like got a shelf where he's got the two things next to each other, and I was just like, this is just too crazy. But it shows like what you're talking about, how people made something from their heart. I feel like the same thing's true in the love of like cinephiles or going to movies or like film culture. Somehow those things happen, like because we give a shit, because somebody pulls it off their shelf and puts it on for no reason at all,
yeah. What are the odds that the two guys that directed Things would sit next to each other?
That's so crazy.
At a cafe.
It never gets
cafe showing one of the weirdest things I've ever seen. I mean, that High 8 film
The High 8 thing was
it was
crazy. I mean, I had a couple good. There's a couple sections that were good, but either way, yeah. I mean, so I know it's a bit of a tangent, but I think it all connects to the why you would do this, why you put on AGFA, and why you still think. And I really am with you on this one, and it kind of goes to Becca's point about streaming, why it's so important to still keep it theatrically alive.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's very important.
I think
it's
a big part of it.
I will still watch things if I'm in a theater.
Yeah,
like it takes a lot for me to walk out of a theater. A lot.
Like you mentioned, things, Video Vortex is our VHS series at the Alamo that plays nationwide at all the Alamos. Mm-hmm. And in March, we did Things. Okay. And it was far and away one of the most talked about and exciting Video Vortexes in history. And it's like, it makes sense because when you're in a theater, you can't escape. You cannot escape Things. And you're just there. You're in it. And it's so important to realize that, like, theatrically, I mean, that movie was never meant to be seen theatrically, but it still has that effect. But seeing it with a full theater of people who are there because they want to be there, it's like nothing else.
And you're not going to turn it off. Like, and I do think some of the people who have probably maybe bought it because I've talked about it on this probably do watch the first minute and go, what? And just don't necessarily, you're not captive. You don't have to be. But I think it's huge. Yeah, I think, so, like for me, I there's one I tried tracking down for years at one point on VHS was Blood Cult. Mm-hmm. Which I hadn't seen, but then when I watched it, I was like,
"It's so boring."
Yeah, exactly.
It's so boring. It's about a cop trying to eat a salad the whole time. He keeps finding fingers in his salad.
It is kind of painful, the pacing, and also just they claim it was the first. I'm sure it wasn't, right?
No, it wasn't. It was either Sledgehammer or Boarding House.
Yeah, and then Sledgehammer, actually has some moments in it that are actually pretty amazing, like really innovative. And interesting, but that's the thing when it's just a normal traditional kind of movie, but shot on video. Mm-hmm. That's usually where it's kind of boring to me.
Yeah, it is.
It's almost like no, we have nothing. Mm-hmm. Let's make something out of that. That's when it's interesting, you know. So I guess ambition plays a role in that. Yeah, Blood Cult. I still have the VHF though. It just isn't my favorite.
And it's like Blood Cult 2. It doesn't get any better. You're hoping maybe this time they're gonna.
No. You keep suffering through.
Yeah.
That was an exciting tangent to be able to go through again. So let's talk about this. Is the one Rob's just pulled up on screen. It's one I've been dying to see, but the timing with Romero's passing is interesting. Is Savini's effects.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that, because I don't really know. This is a movie I did not know about really growing up.
Yeah, I don't think anyone did because it wasn't even available. So they made this movie in the late 70s, and in 1980 it had like a couple of theatrical screenings, and they never really got a distributor for it. It's just kind of one of those things where it fell through the cracks and no one had money. So it was just out there. And then a DVD came out in 2005 that Synapse released. And that's how I was introduced to the movie. And I randomly rented it at a video store in Chicago one night because it said effects, like a snuff movie, and it had Tom Savini's name on it. And I thought, oh, that's cool. Like, I'll check it out. It's Tom Savini. And it was kind of like, I thought it'd be on the same level as something like Nightmares and a Damaged Brain, which was Tom Savini was connected to, and it's pretty good.
Maybe, right? No, doesn't he deny his
He was.
You could tell. It's great effects. That's
there's
why.
Photos of him, too. Oh, okay, that's fine. Yeah, totally. But anyway, so that was like total nerd.
Yeah, that was a pretty nerdy
moment. Guys, there's photos of him on the set. I don't know if you knew that.
But anyway, so I saw FX and I fell in love with the movie because it really scared me.
Oh.
And it takes a lot for movies to scare me because I feel like you watch a lot of horror movies and it's like that hitting those beats that scare you is really important. So I thought it was really great. And I was really taken with it. It was very like a slow pace, like slow burn, but it scared me. It reminded me of like kind of like a Brian De Palma demo movie or something mixed with the Pittsburgh aesthetic.
Oh, so another Pittsburgh film.
Yeah, it's Pittsburgh. Oh, yeah, it's cool. All Pittsburgh. So everyone that worked on that, I mean, the lineage of people who, if not for them, like even like Dawn of the Dead wouldn't even have turned out what it was if it wasn't for like Zilla Clinton, who produced the movie, and Pasquale Bubo, who edited it. They were all so involved. Hmm. But I really love the movie. And so when I first started working at the Alamo Draft House and Sebastian showed me the archive for the first time, my mind was blown just because of all the amazing prints that were there. But then I was like turning the corner and I saw a box that said effects on it. And I was like, that can't be the Pittsburgh effects because it was never released theatrically. There can't be a print of it. And it turned out it was. We had a print of it, and we know now that it's the only print in existence, but at the time I didn't know that.
Sure.
So I booked it for A Terror Tuesday, which is our weekly horror series in Austin, and it sold out. It was really great. People loved it. And then we got an email from John Harrison a few months later, who is the producer and star of the movie. And John Harrison did the score for Creepshow and Day of the Dead.
Directed Creepshow too, didn't he?
And he directed Tales from the Dark Side of the movie.
That's one.
So we got an email from him and he was like, oh, hey, I saw that you show effects. And I didn't know you guys were doing that. And if you do it again, I'd love to come out to the show. And so I was really blown. I was super excited to talk to him because I love the movie so much. So I got on the phone with him really just to tell him how much I love the movie. And like, you guys should know that there are people out there that appreciate this, because it was always like, oh, this thing is garbage because it was never released and no one cares about it. It's too slow. It's boring. Like, whatever. And I loved it. So I wanted them to know that. So I was talking to him about that. And then we just started talking, and I was like, oh, we're starting this new thing with AGFA. We would love to get the movie out there. And he's like, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, do you have any plans for a Blu-ray? And they said, nope. And I said, well, do you want to put this out? And they said, yes. So we were super excited. And it actually, what happened is that the original negative that they had years ago is now lost. And then John had one print and it was badly damaged. So it's no longer around or playable. So it ends up that AGFA has the only, only existing print. So we used our print for the 4K transfer and went from there. It's pretty awesome how that works. And I think it goes to show like the crazy things that happened at the Alamo Drafthouse. Like things are just like, it's like, what? Like, how did this happen from just doing a screening? It's really cool. We're super grateful to be putting it out. And everyone that worked on effects is so sweet and genuine. Like, they cannot believe, like, actually this Tuesday coming up, we're having a casting crew reunion in Austin at Terror Tuesday with all of them. There's like 8 people coming out.
Oh, wow.
And it's the first time they've all been together in decades. They're really pumped. And it's just a really cool feeling to be able to do that for filmmakers that feel like they failed. Like, you know, they all have amazing careers now and they have nothing to be worried about, but this one thing that they really put their hearts into and they feel like all these years has been like, oh, it's this thing we did, and they don't have to be embarrassed anymore because there's going to be 180 people in Austin watching this movie with them, and they can feel like how much love there is. It's really gratifying. It's like to make someone feel that.
So, I feel like that's kind of like Silent Night, Deadly Night 2, when like trying to make Eric realize how great it was, and seeing him accept it, like literally seeing him come to terms with that people actually didn't think it was just a joke. It was kind of cool. Yeah. It's kind of a...
Well, we were all on the hunt for Eric Freeman for years, and we finally got him out.
Is he the star of Silent Night?
He's Silent Night 2. And we had him, the killer from 2, and the killer from 1 together. As a guest on the show together.
Oh, that's amazing. I got to go back and listen to that.
It's great.
It really is. And seeing them talk, even like before they walked in this room, like seeing them backstage and the way they were relating to each other, it was almost like seeing someone like, you're the only person on earth who knows how I feel. Like these two, like that's how it felt. It felt like these two good, like separated brothers who suddenly could like revel in each other's understanding of this character. It's like it was special. I mean, it is special. Like, you know, we do a podcast and sometimes it's just a show, and sometimes there are special beats. You run a theater and sometimes you're going to have a special energy, and it's it keeps this exciting, I think.
Absolutely.
And interesting.
Yeah. And this one comes out August 22nd.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So that one's coming out August 22nd. And
I haven't seen it.
How far along are you in terms of other Blu-ray releases or stuff? Or how does that play into theatrical? Because I assume you're restoring these films because you want people to see them in the theater too. Mm-hmm.
They go hand in hand. I mean, the way we've been doing it is that the month that it's coming out, the first of that month is when it's available theatrically for booking. So like effects has been available August 1st because it comes out August 22nd. So that's the way we've been doing it. Mm-hmm. And as far as the release for AGFA, it's planned out now through December of 2018.
So
we have the next 5 releases are already in the can and being produced. And then we have complete, like next year we have 8 or 9 coming out.
What do you have on the slate?
You're allowed to talk about it.
Yeah, I can tell you the next couple for sure. Okay. After Effects on October 17th is Bat Pussy.
Oh, cool. Yes. I haven't seen it, but I've heard you talk about it on another show.
Yeah, that's another AGFA Something Weird release. Cool. And then after that, we have Ed Wood's The Violent Years in November, which is another AGFA and Something Weird. And then the first of the year in January is one we haven't announced yet. It's The Sword and the Claw, which is a Turkish exploitation movie starring Kunit Arkin, which is mostly known in the U.S. as Lion Man from 1975. So this is another dub of it from the 70s called The Sword and the Claw.
Was that one that was featured in the Turkish ripoff documentary?
Yeah, a Sword and Big Sandal time. Ripoff movie?
Yeah, it's kind of like, actually, it is like Conan the Barbarian meets the Three Stooges meets Dolomite. That's how I explain it to people. It's pretty intense. It's pretty great. It's about a king that gets his hands cut off and his family taken away, and then he's raised by lions, and then he comes back for revenge with these insane lion claws.
He's just pulled up a picture. Yeah. That's phenomenal.
Oh my. Yeah, that's okay, it. I'm in.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So we have that one, and then we're actually, which we also haven't announced, but I guess I'm going to talk about it, is AGFA and Bleeding Skull are teaming up starting in 2018 to put out Blu-rays. So it's going to be kind of like the AGFA and Something Weird, it'll be AGFA and Bleeding Skull.
And what Bleeding Skull titles have you guys put out? So, yeah, because I haven't seen Blonde Death yet. Is that,
you got to see
that
Blonde
put out
Death.
On VHS only?
It's VHS and DVD.
Oh, okay.
And they've been released through Mondo, which is the boutique art label of the Alamo Drafthouse. So they're all available exclusively through Mondo's site. Yeah.
What is Blonde Death? Because I couldn't tell what era it was from. When I saw the stills, I was like, is this a modern film doing a throwback or is it actually an older film? I couldn't tell from the little stills I saw.
Oh, well, that must mean that it's really effective.
Your advertising, marketing, yeah.
Yeah, early 80s.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
And shot by a guy named James Dillinger, right? Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And it's like what happens when John Waters meets OC Hardcore.
And
some of it is actually shot inside Disneyland. What was that movie that was filmed at Disney World?
Escape from Tomorrow.
Yeah. So it's actually, it predates that by 25 years.
Mm-hmm. But it's all stolen Disneyland stuff.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And Jungle Trap, is that a recent one?
Yeah, Jungle Trap just came out last month. Oh, Jungle Trap was an insane experience. I can sum it up in like really quickly if you want.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't there a director who had unfinished work?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So James Bryan, who you guys might know, Don't Go in the Woods.
Okay.
So James Bryan, the director of Don't Go in the Woods, and Renee Harmon, who is his creative partner, and she did Frozen Scream. I don't know if you guys know Frozen Scream. It's from 1980. You might know it.
Yeah,
you should see it. It's really great. Uh-huh. So Renee Harmon is kind of like an unsung woman in exploitation and horror that no one really talks about, but she made truly insane movies.
Huh. What's her name?
Renee Harmon.
Yeah, write that down.
So Renee Harmon and James Bryan had a long creative partnership that started with Lady Street Fighter. And so what happened with Jungle Trap is they had made a couple movies together in the 80s. One was called Run Coyote Run, and it was from 87, which is Renee Harmon had this amazing idea, which is, I don't have the budget to put together a full movie, so why don't I just take pieces of all of my other movies and then shoot new scenes on video and put it all together as one insane, mind-blowing thing. So that's what they did with Run Coyote Run. And then Jungle Trap was the last project they worked on together, which was supposed to be a straightforward, basically, jungle horror movie. And they shot the whole thing, and they shot it basically in Renee's mom's backyard. So they built up a jungle, and it's kind of like a ghost movie. It's like a ghost, like haunted hotel, and there's like killers on the loose, and it's like these Mali warriors who are coming back for revenge. So what happened is that they finished the movie, and no one was interested. Jim's put it together as like a rough cut, like just to show potential distributors, and no one wanted it. There was no music on it. There was no sound effects. It was just like, here's what we can do. We need money to finish it. And it was at the time when, you know, like 1989, 1990, where that kind of direct-to-video shot and video stuff was falling through because people were on. Like they were like, oh, I know what you're doing. You're going to sell me this like shot and video thing. It's not a real movie. So it's kind of like falling by the wayside, especially in places like Blockbuster, who had previously been into that. Like the Polonia Brothers Feeders, like they took that and made it a hit at Blockbuster. But then people started to figure out that it's a shot and video movie, so they didn't want it. So anyway, the bottom fell through and they never finished the movie. And so we released Run Coyote Run with Jim on Bleeding Skull Video. And we were at his house to pick up the master tapes for that. And he has this amazing film barn at his house in Lufkin, Texas, which is like this huge like warehouse, like an airplane hangar with all of his memorabilia and all of his negatives and all of his film. And there's a plastic bin marked Jungle Trap. And we said, Zach and I said, what is Jungle Trap? And he said, oh, that's the last movie Renee and I worked on. We never finished it. Do you want to look at it? And we're like, yes, please. Can we see what this is? So it existed on Beta SP Masters. And so he transferred it for us and sent it to us. And Zach, Annie, and I sat down and watched Jungle Trap in its raw form. And we were so entertained by it. And we thought, you know, like all of the hard work that Renee Harmon put into her career, and it never got her anywhere. And Jim Bryan, too, to a certain extent, we thought this should be out there. Like this, their last masterpiece that they made together should be out there. So we asked Jim if we could help him finish the movie. And he said yes. So we hired an editor, Don Suenos, who edited the movie. And then Annie and I recorded the soundtrack on vintage synthesizers so that it'd be very authentic to the era. And we did a new sound mix, and we finished the movie with Jim, and we put it out, and we premiered it at Fantastic Fest last year, and it was amazing. It was the first time he had seen it ever. It was with a crowd at Fantastic Fest. So it was just a really cool and insane experience.
That's wild.
I'm researching this woman. I'm obsessed with her now.
She's amazing.
Wow. And she also acted in a movie called Van Nuys Boulevard, which is apparently an exploitation film about Van Nuys Boulevard.
Wow. Yeah, it's good. You should check it out.
Okay,
yeah.
I just wrote it down. I will have it by next week.
You should also write down Escape from the Insane Asylum.
Yes.
Escape from the Insane Asylum.
Key work of Renee Harmon.
Absolutely.
And what's the relationship been like with Mondo? Because obviously they have a very, you know, they're kind of a big part of the collector's market,
yeah,
in all avenues with vinyl and everything. So how's it been getting access to that audience specifically for these movies?
I think every single day we have asked ourselves, oh, I cannot believe, why are they doing this? How is it possible? Because it's like, you know, Mondo is putting out the Back to the Future soundtrack and then they're putting out Night Feeder by Bleeding Skull. And it's like, what? Like, doesn't really.
Bless them.
Yes, exactly. So it's been great. We've been very lucky and they've been so sweet to us. And so it's kind of a dream to actually do that with them. It's been great.
We were going to talk about gems and we'd love to hear what you guys mm-hmm. brought to the mm-hmm. table. But the ones that I want to bring up are, because I'm originally from Long Island, New York, mm-hmm. and I discovered these on DVD and
are you going to say Nathan Schiff?
Yes, I am.
Okay, give me the name of this one.
His name is Nathan Schiff and he made, was it three films? Mm-hmm. The ones I remember, they were on DVD briefly.
Yeah.
Long Island Cannibal Massacre.
Yes.
They Don't Cut the Grass Anymore. Mm-hmm. And Weasels Rip My Flesh.
Yep.
Which is a wonderful
these
title.
Are amazing titles.
Yeah, they're great titles.
Weasels Rip My Flesh.
What do you know about these films? Do you still have the DVDs? Because yeah. I regret not having them anymore.
I do. It's amazing you brought this up. He's one of my all-timers for Bleeding Skull. He's
really?
One of my all-time All right. favorite Bleeding Skull filmmakers, Nathan Schiff. Yeah, I know a lot about him. <It's> yeah. You know, his movies for me completely, this aesthetic I'm talking about, where this thing coming from someone else that it can't possibly come from anyone else. This idea that a teenager on Long Island when he was 16 years old spent $500 to make a full length movie on Super 8.
Yeah.
And it turns out being this incredibly dreamy, like, landscape of like gore and all of his influences and his relatives and like all of this stuff thrown together is something so charming and so wonderful about it. And the movies are actually great. Like, they're all so good. I mean, They Don't Cut the Grass Anymore. It gets really gory and really hard to watch.
Yeah, I'm looking at pictures of it right now. It looks like they used real entrails.
They did. Yeah, okay. It's super intense. And that one's like really intense. But it's also a satire. That was one he's like, I'm 18 now, so I'm going to say something about consumerism in America, you know, about through this gore movie. But it's really fascinating. Like, incredible that he did it. He made another one called Vermilion Eyes in the early 90s, which is like, have you seen it's real deal. It's like stepping up to the next like adult. Listen, an adult growing out of these movies to make this like serious exploitation horror movie.
See, wow. I felt like when we were doing I knew you guys were coming on, I have some, but we've been doing the show for so long, like 140. I feel like all the ones I wanted to talk about, I've already talked about. I kind of want to listen.
Yeah, no, we want the recommendations.
Yeah, I kind of want to hear some of the gems. I mean, there's ones like the only one that always comes up for me because I still haven't found a good copy is Candy Snatchers. It's just a movie. Mm-hmm. I wish there was a nice clean version, but I guess copyright hell.
I have the DVD of it, but it's not pretty.
Yeah, I would say that at this point, the DVD is most likely maybe one of the last times it's going to be. I don't know. It's on home video.
Because they couldn't check. No one's been able to trace the ownership, right?
Yeah, it's pretty messy.
Messy, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a shame. But I have things like that, but I feel like I've talked about them so much. I'd really like to hear, I'm more interested to hear mm-hmm. about some, you know, the ones that you recommend to people or things that you just personally love.
Okay.
Oh, no, both of you or either of you.
Okay. Well, I did write down some.
Yes.
Because you guys asked me to, so thanks for that. So a subgenre of horror that I really find comforting in the same way I find like Buster Keaton silent comedies comforting mm-hmm. is 1950s and 60s Mexican horror movies.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
So a lot of people know them through the versions that were dubbed by K. Gordon Murray and imported into the U.S. like The Brainiac is a big one mm-hmm. and El Vampiro. World of the Vampires. And they're all really comforting and fascinating to me because they have the gothic feel of universal horror movies, but they are done on budgets far less than that. So you kind of get this, this very more of a low budget feel of what someone's interpreting universal monsters as. Mm-hmm. And they're really fascinating and they're really fun and comforting and charming. And so my favorite one that I've come across is called Ship of Monsters from mm-hmm. 1960. And the really cool thing about that movie is that I guess, first glance, it's a horror movie. It's a horror movie about a ship of monsters. But the interesting thing about how it got there is that the plot of the movie is that two women from Venus, and on Venus, they have no men, so they have to go across the galaxy to find men to marry so that they can make more people. They pick up, like, the most grotesque monsters, like, lo-fi monsters you've ever seen in the 1950s. They are incredible-looking, like, insane monsters.
Oh, yeah.
So they pick up these monsters and put them on the ship, and then they land in Mexico, and there's this, like, kind of, like, singing cowboy they meet in Mexico, and it turns into, like, this, like, pop musical with this cowboy, and then he fights the monsters, and then there's a robot that comes out at the end and fights everyone. And it is just so much, it's just pure joy in the form of like, it's a like a Mexican horror movie musical sci-fi, like, and the songs are great because everyone's having so much fun. I usually hate musicals. Like, I can't even get 5 minutes into a musical, but this movie is just like, oh, it's so nice. And it's so insane. Like, the visuals, you're like, this is 1960? Like, these monsters are totally crazy. They look so weird.
I can vouch for it. You just pulled up some photos.
And it was so funny. I just happened to be going through the photos as you mentioned everything. Like, yeah, like as the robots, monster.
I got a PowerPoint slide.
Yeah, pretty much. That was pretty funny. Oh, cool. Ship of Monsters. And is this difficult to track down? Or?
Yeah, there's a Mexican DVD that doesn't have subtitles, so what you have to do is buy the DVD and download the subtitles and then combine them on your computer if you want subs. Or you could download, you know, like,
or ask somebody to do it.
It's probably on YouTube. I'm sure it's on YouTube. But that one is one of the best of those kind.
Cool.
That looks cool.
What about you, Brett? Do you have a recommendation for us?
I've heard you guys talk about Arrow's American Horror Project box set.
I
really want people to see Malatesta's Carnival of Blood. I really want people to see it. It's a phenomenal discovery. It's off the charts discovery. It's like Carnival of Souls meets Messiah of Evil.
Wow.
And it's truly off the rails, and it's both intentional art, like hard math, strange camera choices, and like, why are we looking at their shoulder?
Did the guy own the carnival? Is that how assumed it was some guy who owned a carnival. He was like, hey, we could shoot here off season.
The guy directed is Christopher Spieth, who primarily did commercials and documentaries. And we're burying the lead. Hervé Villechaize co-stars in the movie. It's just got this amazing found trash prop aesthetic, kind of like Wayne White, Pee-wee's Playhouse. At one point, there's a giant puppet head that is talking, and I realized, oh, they took a Volkswagen Bug and turned it upside down, and the hood of the car is the mouth of the puppet. There's just really inventive stuff going on.
Wow.
And the loose premise of the movie is that the impresario of the carnival, Mr. Malatesta, hires people to lures them to work at the carnival so that he can then kidnap them and feed them to the cannibals living in the cave underneath the carnival, who are watching scratchy 16mm silent films like Phantom of the Opera while they're tearing their victims apart. Stunning. I don't know what to say about it.
It's like Midnight Meat Train with like the cave, and yeah, there's a lot going on there. I feel like I need to see this. Yeah.
I hope they do more another follow-up to that.
Another collection?
Yeah.
I talked to Fran at Arrow, and he told me one title of the volume two, and I'm totally forgetting it. I don't remember what it was.
Yeah. Oh, but there is a volume two coming.
Yeah, I feel
maybe.
Like
I don't know.
With the volume one, The Witch That Came from the Sea seemed to get all the action, just because I guess it has a lot of penises in it, so that does it.
Literal action.
Yeah.
They're all so different, all those three movies.
Yeah. Vastly. And that's one that we didn't discuss when we did Rape Revenge films a couple of weeks ago. By far the best cover art of like many, many movies.
What's
amazing
the other one?
Cover
the psychic. What's it called?
The Premonition.
I actually found that one because I knew nothing about it and I heard the least about it in terms of people going crazy. I actually really enjoyed watching that one. I thought it was interesting. But the Witch Who Came from the Sea is actually pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. Actually a good movie, quality performance, interesting thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's two. And that one's much easier for people to track down.
Yeah.
Anyone else?
I'll throw in one. And this one is, I will say, I wrote an article about this on Blumhouse, and for years it had been my holy grail of you will never find a copy of this movie. And within minutes of me posting it, somebody sent me a YouTube link.
Cool. Nice.
I was like, fuck you, internet, but that's kind of awesome. Yeah. So this one's called Atrepados. And have you guys heard of this?
I've heard of this.
Excellent. It is from 1981. And I saw a bootleg copy of this when I was in college. And I have not seen it since. And I need to watch the YouTube link to see if it is as good as
what
I remember.
What is it? Actual what?
Atrepados. It is the, I want to say the Spanish, you might be able to translate this. It's Spanish for caught up or trapped or something like that. Maybe?
Nope,
probably not.
Bell, okay.
So Atrepados, from what I remember, it is about a group of people in this apartment building, and there is some type of earthquake or natural disaster, and everybody gets trapped in the basement, and they can't get out, and they set up their own society down there, but they are trapped there for years. And they set up their own society.
Oh, this is
and
then, people who are in the dark too.
No. But this is where you'll like it. I remember that you would, this is kind of like your movie, Elric, because after a while they set up their own society and it's not very many, it's like four people, but it starts becoming unclear if things are real or not, because things start getting really fantastical while they're down there and they can't get out. And from there, it's kind of like you don't know what's going on, or this is all in somebody's head or anything like that. I remember that it, when I researched it before, it was like a film that it had done a festival run in the 1980s. It had never gotten a release anywhere. Some bootleg copies have come out. Apparently there's one on the internet now.
Yes, it is on YouTube. And yes. it's trapped.
Atrapados.
Okay. It means trapped in Spanish.
Spanish is awful.
And it's directed by a guy who did a notable, interesting late 80s horror, I think. I'm pulling that out of my head.
Matthew Patrick is the director?
And he did some kind of like really awesome.
Hider in the House?
Yes, that's
it.
So,
bless the IMDb.
I need to rewatch. I'm going to see this. Atrapados. I need to rewatch it.
Hider in the House is the one with creepy Gary Busey standing behind the girl in the box. Yeah, wow.
I need to rewatch this to remember if it's as awesome as I remember it. It's black and white, even though that it was 80s. I recall it being black and white the whole way through. But I remember seeing it in college and being like, this movie is everything. And then I was never able to see it again. Okay. And it never had a release. Like, I don't even think it
don't
went
ever watch
to
it
VHS.
Again.
Never.
Let those lingering phantoms guide you in life. Mm-hmm. There's nothing better than that.
I'd love to talk about some of the Canadian stuff that I've loved over the years.
Oh, yeah. Connexploitation is one of my favorite.
One of my absolute favorites is Deadline. Do you know Deadline?
Deadline.
This one's so hot. It's like 1980. I don't know the actual year, because I've seen things as wild as like 1980 and then 1987. Uh-huh, so it's like one of those IMDb wormhole things. Right. And it's about a Stephen King-esque author and screenwriter who has extreme writer's block. So half the movie alternates between his dreary home life of his coked out wife and his whining son and daughter. And it alternates between that and fantasy sequences of extreme like high concept gore that you're imagining his imagining of what he's trying to break through his writer's block with. And there's a scene where a telepathic goat turns on a thresher that a farmer is working on and sucks him into the thresher and decapitates him. There's a whole sequence where there's a Nazi mad scientist who figures out that this one rock band can play a certain frequency that makes hobos' guts explode.
Wow.
And it works.
Wow. Yeah.
What is the name of this movie
again?
Deadline.
It sounds like a more fun Cat in the Brain. Like, yeah. I mean, I know a lot of people love Cat in the Brain, but there's something not that fun about Cat in the Brain.
It
plunks along.
There's nothing to get to the gore. I mean, there's gore in it, but there's very little meat.
I mean,
get
the idea is great, and I love that he's dressed like Elmer Fudd.
He has that great hat on.
Yeah, he really does look great. But.
It's got a good soundtrack.
Another really hot one is Murder by Phone.
I just saw the trailer for that for the first time.
AKA Bells, with Richard Chamberlain and John Houseman.
Yeah.
And it's Scanners, but with like a payphone.
Yeah.
And it turns out, this will make you see it. Spoiler, it's about the evil telephone company. It's a conspiracy with the phone company and the government to like blow people's heads up.
Phil Blankenship showed the trailer for it before Lisa, when he did his feature of Scream for Help, Stepfather and Lisa. And it was the trailers in between. He did a great job programming those.
Did you see Scream for Help?
Oh, man.
Yeah.
It was amazing, right?
It brought the house
so good.
It is currently streaming on Vudu. Yeah, so you don't have to be in LA to see it.
But it was such a good like audience.
Oh,
movie.
I totally believe it.
It really was. It was just so much fun. All right, you're back up. What do you got?
Let's see, back up. Well, I'm going to stay in the Mexican horror arena, and I'm going to go ahead about 30 years to 1988 to a movie called Don't Panic.
Okay.
I don't know if you guys have heard of this movie.
I have a number of Mexican horrors on my list, but I don't have Don't Panic, so do go on, sir.
So Don't Panic is something I discovered through Bleeding Skull, and then it was another movie when I moved to Austin and saw the AGFA archive and noticed that actually it was beforehand, because I did Don't Panic at CineFamily from AGFA's print. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's very much in part of AGFA, because we have a print and it's like, you know, no one has a print of this movie. But anyway, this movie Don't Panic is really notable because the great thing that happened with Mexican horror in the late 80s is that they were just looking to other movies in America that were really popular and completely ripping them off. So you get a movie like Trampa Infernal, which is the Freddy Krueger, Mexican Freddy Krueger, but you know, he has the Freddy claw and stuff, but he also has a machine gun. So
one ups it.
And that's what it makes these movies so excellent, because it's like, again, like no rules here. Let's just do this, but do it better. So Don't Panic is really cool because it's another Nightmare on Elm Street ripoff. But the interesting thing about it is that the main character, whose name is Michael, he is a high school kid. He's like a regular high school kid, rides his BMX to bike. He's fallen in love with his girlfriend. But then he goes home at night and he puts on a pair of dinosaur pajamas. And when I say dinosaur pajamas, I mean full on, he is an adult, like a 20 something man wearing children's pajamas.
Oh,
that
like
have
total
dinosaurs.
Onesie?
Oh, no, they're actually the twosie. They're like the like Superman underoos,
oh,
like back in the 80s.
Totally.
Yeah.
Underoos.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
They're like that. So he wears this through the entire movie while he's battling demons and trying to save his friends from, you know, like this Freddy Krueger esque thing. And it is absolutely amazing, like crowd slaying, incredibly fun movie that just delivers on all levels. And a lot of people don't really know about it. And it's so fun. It's so good.
Is it because this cover that I'm looking at looks like it's an English title? Is it English language dubbed or
it's
something?
Dubbed. It's
oh,
dubbed
cool.
In English. Yeah. Yeah.
Huh.
And this is something that is, it might play at Friday Night Frights here in LA at CineFamily, maybe end of September.
Oh, okay. Like cool.
All right.
Ooh, yeah, yeah.
That's the way we got to see it then.
Keep me up at midnight, maybe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nice.
As long as it's under 2 hours.
Oh, it is.
When yeah. they recently showing The Tenant at midnight, I was just like, come on, guys. You don't. That's a movie to start at 10 p.m.
I don't think any movie needs to be 2 hours,
yeah.
Period.
Yeah, I know. Well, especially in the kind of movies we're talking about.
Yeah.
It's always like
88-minute sweet spot.
Mine's 72.
Oh,
like
yeah.
72 is
yeah.
it. That's it.
Pretty good. We went to see Eyes of Fire last fall, and that one was at midnight. And I was like, I will see this in a theater because I loved the VHS so much. From my childhood, and even that one, and I mean that one's like crazy demonic
yeah,
kids running around,
sequences.
Amazing stuff. And even that one, I was like, I'm fading, I'm fading. Oh, demon kids back! I'm still fading. So.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes, like if it was like Sledgehammer or something, which is how I saw Sledgehammer was at CineFamily. You know, when it first you guys first, but seeing that at midnight made total sense because the being delusional actually helps.
Yeah,
just like the Beyond, right? Where we'd fall asleep for a bit of the Beyond, you wake
and
up
then
and
we'd
go,
wake
oh,
up.
Shit.
All three of us saw. We went to the screening of the Beyond at the.
That's how we
all.
We're getting old.
And all three of us fell asleep, and we'd like wake up at intervals and be like,
and we feel like we're in the Beyond.
Doesn't really matter.
Yeah, totally.
Like, doesn't.
Part
it doesn't.
Of it. Yeah.
No, it's kind of a magical. You probably missed, you know, the clunky part, which is great.
Yeah, I'd wake up. Exactly. There's spiders pulling people's faces off, and I'm back out.
Right.
So,
Don't panic. I'm in.
Yeah. It's very exciting.
I've got one that challenges everyone's notion of the 2000s. So part of this fun that we get to have at AGFA with all of our label partners is that the Intervision titles are also part of what we can put in the theaters, which is really exciting. And the biggest discovery for me is, okay, so in the mid-2000s, Bruno Mattei decided to make a run of movies as if no one told him it wasn't the 80s anymore. So he basically made 80s Bruno Mattei movies in the 2000s. And the one that really got me... It's titled on DVD, Island of the Living Dead. I don't know what its original title is, but this tore my head off. I couldn't believe how entertained minute by minute I was. And apparently, according to David Gregory of Severin, they're all like that.
Huh.
So Island of the Living Dead was just primo horseshit.
Have they put that out yet?
Somebody,
they did because I saw
Dave Parker owns them all.
Yeah, no, my friend, one of my friends brought it over not too long ago, and I was into it. He's like, let's just watch the first few minutes and see if this is going to be the movie.
Yeah.
And he vetoed it. He was like, no.
Vetoed it.
Yeah, he's like, 5 minutes, like, no. And I'm like, but it's kind of crazy already.
He is not a curious person because that movie instantly raises the antenna of anyone who's curious about
it. It was pretty crazy what we saw. So, no, I'm going to go back to it.
You're
not
going to out him on the show. You'll tell me after.
No, I will.
who am I publicly shaming?
Was there kind of just a native prejudice about a movie from 2006? Is that why it was
No. Honestly, I think we'd already agreed to watch something else. So it was kind of like already in our heads, like, well, we're watching this tonight. But then it's like, but I brought this. So if this is amazing, maybe we'll watch both. But no.
That's a shame. The first 5 minutes holds an immense amount of promise for anyone who's into just weird stuff of any kind. So,
yeah. All right.
There's like incredibly bad dubbing. There's like a women in prison island subplot, and there's pirates, and then shit blows up. I mean, come on. Shit blows up.
Island of the Living Dead. Yes.
This one wasn't on the list I prepared today, and it's definitely not exploitation, but I just discovered an Italian horror film from the 2000s that I was like, why have I never seen this? It was actually a lot of fun called Red Riding or it's not Red Riding Hood. It's like Red Hood or something like that. Hmm. It's from 2001, Rob. See if you can look it up. It's a female protagonist. She's probably 13 and she actually narrates the entire film while she goes around and kills her classmates and her family. And she's being raised by her grandmother. And the whole time she's being followed around by this giant, like 7-foot wolf with this metal mask on.
Whoa.
And it's crazy. Hmm. And I had never seen this before, but I stumbled on it a couple of weeks ago and it was blind buy for me, but I was pleasantly surprised. And that's a picture of the giant wolf with the metal mask.
Oh, is this 2003?
2003.
But the creative title, Red Riding Hood.
Yeah, okay, it is Red Riding Hood. I was like, I swear
not
there's something
you wouldn't
more
be able to find it.
But it's weird because she like narrates as she goes along and she's the killer too. So it's from her perspective as she kills people.
Cover right there.
And Vincent Gallo behind the mask, right?
We can
fingers crossed. Let's just all believe that.
Yeah, it definitely was not a flawless movie, but it was definitely one that I was like, why have I never seen this? And it has some really interesting notes to
cool.
it. So
that sounds good to me.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
So any other gems before we...
Before we wrap up.
Yeah, I mean, I want to talk about the movie The Love Witch.
Okay.
I don't know if you guys have seen The Love Witch.
I saw it
in 2016.
I haven't yet, and it was because of my love of these kind of movies that I actually haven't watched it, because I have almost this reverse fear from the trailer that it's going to be not satirizing, but there's this feeling of like imitation, uncanny almost.
So, without capturing the essence.
What you have described, I hate. I hate that in movies. I hate it so much. And I think I felt the same way because I mean, honestly, the trailer from The Love Witch, it's not the greatest.
Yeah.
Not the greatest. But so The Love Witch, I was really, really into because for a long time, I didn't follow new horror movies. I was like, I've had enough. Like, I think, you know, we were talking about Rob Zombie. Like, Rob Zombie's Halloween 2, I went to see that at the theater. I'm like, I'm done. Like, I don't need to see any more movies at the theater. No offense to anyone that's listening that loves that movie. It's just, you know, different strokes, different folks. So I was kind of like, there's so much good stuff in the past to watch that I haven't seen. So I'm just going to focus on that. And so one of my colleagues at the Alamo, Tommy Swenson, gave me a screener for this movie, The Love Witch. And he's like, I think you should watch this. And I'm like, what is it? And he was like, I'm not going to tell you anything. Just go home tonight and watch it. And I watched it and I loved it so much because I really like, it reminded me a lot of what like John Landis did with Schlock and Stuart Gordon did with From Beyond, which is taking their love for genre and making it into something new by also paying tribute to what they love about it. And The Love Witch was really like that for me too. I thought it was like the first horror movie in a really, really long time that really felt like it was doing something different. And it was taking genre and moving it to the next level. Like, this is something brand new, because I think the filmmaker Anna Biller, who did it, she did all the sets herself. She sewed everything that happened. She painted every painting.
In her previous film, she's the star, too.
Yeah, Viva. Yeah.
I had seen Viva before.
Yeah. And Viva's like way different. Viva is very much like, it's so goofy and so like, but The Love Witch to me is very sincere. And it's like, it's like taking your influences and making something totally new with it. I think it's really unique. It's a really like new revision, you know, for genre. I think it's a really special movie. So
I now promise I will watch it.
You might dig it. I like Anna a lot as a person. And I think she is of another mentality as a filmmaker. Like, because again, like you said, like she makes all the designs and she sees the world in a very different way based on my conversations with her. These aren't for me. Viva or The Love Witch, but I get why people like it. And there is a sincerity and genuine nature to it. It's not like trying to rip off what her influences are. It's like she really believes those influences.
Season of a Witch one of the Romero's like an influence on it, because aesthetically when I saw the trailer, it's like, oh, it kind of looks like that.
I would say it's part of the lineage of The Love Witch, just because Season of the Witch is very much about a woman being liberated from something that is not, she doesn't want to be a part of, and I feel like The Love Witch is an extension of that. So I feel like there's like their descendants. They're definitely not aesthetically the same or like topically, but the feeling is the same, like the general feeling behind it.
While I've got your brains here, I do want to ask you about one movie. I once saw, so I grew up on the Aunt Timpson cinema, because that's where I grew up in New Zealand.
So I got to see
every year of the Incredibly Strange Film Festival, which was his festival.
It's the reason he says innovative.
Whatever I say, I don't know. But there was one movie. So earlier on, I was asking you guys like where the astrologer came from, and he had these great guidebooks where he had put like symbols of alligator teeth or whatever happened, you know, carnage. He really is honestly a master showman, like really one of the best. I wish he had done some of that here, because it was before I think Draft House even existed. He was doing crazy shit like that. But he once showed a movie and he claimed, or the claim was, that it was found on the Manson Ranch. The only film print of it was found like after the Mansons, long after they'd gone, been evicted. They had found this one print of the film, and it was psyched by the 4D witch.
Oh my God, yes.
And so I got to see that on a film print.
Oh my God.
This is like 15 years ago. And he said, like, it could be, like, I don't think he was saying it's the worst film ever, but it was like, he didn't put it in that terms. Like, he wasn't saying this is bad. It wasn't a quality thing, but they were putting, like, you know, this is one of the craziest things you'll ever witness. And I remember going to this at, maybe I was only like 17 or something.
Oh, wow.
And I just remember it stayed with me forever, but especially the song. I love the song. That's, I think somebody could cover that. She comes from the belly of the devil, bitch. Mm-hmm. So beware of the 4D witch. So good. but that little bit of lore, whether it's just like Fargo starting based on a true story.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether it fucking is or not. It added something to my experience of watching a movie going, oh yeah, I could totally imagine the Mansons were watching the, you know, Manson family are just sitting around watching this movie on repeat and all the trippy imagery. But that's a movie, I think that might have been a something
it
weird.
It was?
Yeah. Oh, wow.
A long time ago.
With Monster
Ago. It's one of those films where every year I'll go online and look, see if there's a poster in existence, you know, and just search and see nothing. There's never anything. But
Lisa, it's something weird in her paper archive of something where they have all of the materials for that movie. They have the poster and the press kit, and the press kit's amazing because they're actually trying to sell that as like a horror movie.
Yeah.
It's incredible that they're doing that. Yeah.
It's weird sex magic and like acid trippy photography. Nuts. Yeah.
And the whole thing looks like it was actually transferred on someone's bedroom wall and they were filming like the projecting on a bedroom wall. It looks so otherworldly.
I wonder whose print it was back then that Ant would have been screened, because it was like a perfect print. Like we're just in a, you know.
There's actually a couple prints out there. Okay. Like it was, there's like at least three that I know of, which is crazy.
Well, please, whatever happens, please let me introduce this movie if it ever plays in LA. Let's make that happen. Just because my brain will be blown to see it again.
Yeah, and for anyone that's listening, it's definitely not for human beings. No, it is far beyond.
That's why I've chosen tonight to reveal my true self.
Yeah.
That's actually something that I want. I kind of want to change the public opinion about movies like that. Yeah. You know, they're not for human beings. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in the past, films like that have always been considered like the hard stuff or the real horror junkie or the exploitation junkie. We've been having these conversations about reframing it so it's not trash, but it's actually for connoisseurs. It's like a Grey Poupon moment where like, have you seen The Soul Tangler?
Yeah.
I've got The Soul Tangler.
Yeah.
And opening up the base of people who could potentially be interested in them by saying, this is for people with finer tastes.
Well, right. I endorse that as someone who was psyched by the 4D witch.
Yeah.
I endorse this idea.
And I also feel like the world's ready, more ready than they ever have been for things like that, because I think one of the great things about the internet and Twitter is that it's brought people together who have previously not felt comfortable talking about these things with other people because people looked down on it for so many years. And I think now the world is what we're finding out is a lot of the work that you guys are doing on your show, you know, it's like you find out there's so many people that have a love for these things. And it's like you don't feel alone. It's like Bat Pussy to me is a movie I never would have told my parents that AGFA is releasing. Like, Mom and Dad, I'm working on this softcore porn movie. It's one of the first porn parodies in the world. You know, to be like, oh God, I'm not going to tell my parents. But now I'm like proud of it. Yeah. And I feel like it's because I feel like there's other people out there that are going to accept it for what it is. And like Brett's exactly right. I mean, that's part of AGFA's mission too. It's that saying like, hey, you guys aren't alone. Like we're here too.
Totally.
Like, you should love this stuff.
And it's a collective experience that you want to continue. And these are movies that a lot of them probably were never really experienced collectively. They're probably just experienced, you know, on a VHS tape and that's it. So to actually get people in a room, people will never understand unless you can make it to a screening someday. And the times I've gotten to a draft house, it definitely has that, you know, Cine Family New Beverly in LA have these kind of feelings. But if you, to see something like whether it's Abby, when we saw Abby.
Oh God, that was magical.
You know, that really was special. Like that's not like, oh, it's so funny because it's bad. No. This is a great movie and we're laughing because it's incredible. And because it's ripping off. Ripping off something, but it's doing it in it's a whole nother movie.
Yeah, it's because your mind can't process it. So you laugh. It's like you laugh at things, like you laugh in the face of trauma.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing. It's and all that stuff about So Bad It's Good, it's like burn that shit to the ground. It's like there's no room for it in the world anymore. It's like over.
Well, it's just the wrong way to put it.
It is.
It's that it's so crazy it's good. It's so crazy it's great. That's why it's so great, you know? But
which
God
leads me
it.
To one more title, which I bought a prop for.
Oh, oops,
shit. Oh, boy.
So, and this one's accessible. 1967's The Acid Eaters, which I love so much, I own the novelization for.
Yeah, I have that too.
That is awesome. Yeah.
Nerds unite.
Nerds, go. So this one you can find through Something Weird. But yeah, this was one for me that I feel like time really just kind of overlooked. Everyone remembers Roger Corman's The Trip and some of the other drugsploitation films, but The Acid Eaters for me is where it's at because the movie is – like it's not made for, you know, normal minds to consume, and mm-hmm. nothing makes sense in it. And it's not supposed to, because it is supposed to be about literally a group of like office workers who go to a pyramid in the middle of nowhere and decide to take acid. And then like some of them die, but come back. One of them dresses up as a devil. There's a whole bunch of like weird motorcycle trike action in there. Everyone's naked.
Yep.
And it's absolutely
amazing.
This
is officially my favorite episode because I'm just looking at pornography while she's talking.
Yeah,
like she's literally passed me a book of pornography. I'm just sitting again. Pornography. This is great.
So, yeah, the acid eaters and the drugsploitation genre. Like, you guys know me from the nunsploitation films being one of my favorite of the exploitation. And I thought about bringing my, like, School of the Holy Beast killer nun type
films. Yeah.
But, yeah, like, the drugsploitation stuff is definitely one that I've absolutely loved as well and does not get nearly as much love as it should. There are so many out there that people have overlooked, from like the weed people, and just there's many. So, but the acid eaters, if you're going to start somewhere, head to acid eaters.
Acid eaters is great. And Lisa from Something Weird had the best way to sum up the acid eaters. And she said, it's like your grandpa making an LSD movie.
It really is.
Wow.
It really, because yeah. you watch it and like you can picture your mom in it, because they're yeah. not supposed to be like crazy teens. Whoa. They actually posit them as like, these are standard office workers who are traveling to this area to do acid for the weekend. And they really do posit it as like normal people. They could be your mom and dad. And then like 5 minutes later, they're naked and one of them's missing a head and the devil is there. And yeah, it gets crazy. So,
and piggybacking on that, have you seen The Weird World of LSD?
I have not seen this one.
You should write that down.
Yeah. Okay.
It's another like grandpa making drugsploitation movie, which is like, you know, what he thinks that it's like what the kids are doing on drugs.
Now, one of my favorite other exploitation subgenres that we haven't talked a lot about on this show because they don't tend to fall into horror is Mondo films.
Yeah.
But there's like one that's just on New York City that is absolutely crazy. I wore the shirt for one of my favorite ones last week, Sex Rituals of the Occult.
Yes. You got compliments.
I did. Somebody actually knew what it was. I've worn that shirt so many times and everybody's like, what does that mean? And I'm like, it's a movie, 1970, you know what, never mind. But yeah, I love some of like the weird baddie Mondo films that are like now impossible to find. Everyone just knows like Mondo, Kane, and then it goes straight to Faces of Death.
Yeah.
And then all the Faces of Death knockoffs. But there was some really fascinating ones that came out in the 70s.
Were any of you at the CineFamily Faces of Death screening? With the director Q&A?
No, but I've heard it's crazy.
Oh, that was one of my favorite memories.
There's two of them, right? Like a man
Weird
and a woman.
Weird World of LSD.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or is it just the guy?
It's just the guy. Uh-huh. And he had never done a Q&A before. And I'm just remembering it. It's just a fun night.
They had a weird YouTube channel like where they just reviewed movies. And it's just super bizarre. The Faces of Death director on this weird. And it's like mainstream movies. It just nothing about it felt right. It kind of made me more uneasy about the whole thing.
Wow. Well, the documentary on the Blu-ray of the Making of Faces of Death.
Oh, I haven't watched it.
Which is so meta, yeah. You can't even comprehend.
Oh, I've got to watch that.
Yeah, yeah. I liked it better than the actual movie. But
yeah. I don't know if you're meant to enjoy it. I don't know. Maybe.
Did you guys?
So how did the Q&A go? Was it just bizarre?
It was bizarre and incredibly revealing. He didn't want to hold anything back about what he thought about the movie or his intentions. So he had really sincere intentions when he made the movie.
Wow. Now, was he the one who played the doctor? I can't even – Dr. B. Grossum or something
that.
For some reason, I always thought that was the director.
No,
not
the
him.
The guy who made it at the time, he was probably in 30 when he directed it. So he was like a young guy who wanted to break into the business and somehow got that gig. It was made for the Japanese market, as I recall.
Wow.
Anyway,
that somehow makes sense because that would have hit like right after the end of the Guinea Pig series. So that makes sense that would kind of been like the aesthetic then.
I love Mondo movies. Mm-hmm. They're some of my favorites. Have you done The Killing of America?
Yeah, we've talked about that quite a bit.
Oh, man.
Yeah. That was a big one growing up for me.
That might be my favorite.
And right now, there's periods of America, like the last 8 years, where it felt far away.
Mm-hmm.
That documentary and the current political climate might be, it's almost like a direct lineage to where we're at. It's
totally.
See how it connects. It's kind of disturbing.
Elric brought it up on the show a while back, and I bought an import of it because at the time that was the only way we can get it. And for some reason, I was just scared to watch it.
I'm scared to watch it.
I like
still
horror movies,
it.
But when it comes to real life violence, I'm a scaredy cat about myself.
Oh, I cry.
Me too. I can't.
Yeah. I can't do it.
Yeah.
Severin did that. Severin.
Yeah,
Severin did that amazing Blu-ray, and literally it arrived on election night, and that is what me and my roommate watched.
Wow.
And we were just like looking at each other, like this could not have come at a more appropriate time. even more so now.
But it's great because you also do learn when you see all those things connection, and there'll be ways out of this. But it's not as bleak as all that. But it is really interesting to see because it's like a highlight reel of doom.
Oh my god! Yeah.
But it kind of at least means you understand how it was connected in a sense. And without that, I think I don't know. I think that piece is a really special piece of like filmmaking. I don't know anything about the person who made it though.
There's some stuff on the Blu-ray, if I remember correctly. Huh. Yeah.
There's a really good book on Mondo Films, which the name is escaping me right now, but it was part of that, not Jack Sargent, I can't remember his name, but it was the recreation books that came out in the 90s. Is anyone else remembering
these? Yeah, it's, I know the one you're talking about.
I can't remember the name of it. But there was a really good book that came out in the late 90s on Mondo Films that like documented all of them. And it was part of the series. It was like a whole series of really good books, most of which I have. I can't remember the name. It's called Death Trip. Death Tripping was about the rise of the punk films, Nick Zedd's films and things like that. That was the Death Tripping one, but it's the same series.
Same series, yeah.
Yeah.
How can people like support? Because I have already told you, I started really cool t-shirts of American Genre Film Archive on the Mondo side and like a hat. And like, are there ways to like support the idea of this besides just buying the films?
To tell the person who runs your local cinema to play more genre movies. Hmm. Because one of the great things about this new ACFA program is bringing genre movies to venues which had previously never played them and having a more even playing field venue-wise for where Reanimator could live.
Yeah.
You know?
So maybe like a little grassroots, if you're in a town that doesn't play that stuff, but you know enough people who might be into it, get together and go make an argument to your local theater.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I mean, if you want to directly help ACFA, it's a nonprofit. So there's a donate button on the site at AmericanGenreFilm.com. And you can donate to ACFA.
Does buying merch donate the money back to ACFA?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
And it is called Killing for Culture, Death Films from Mondo to Snuff. It is Creation Books, and it's by David Slater.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I think we have just the right audience for all of this, to be honest. So I think, you know, hopefully you guys will be interested to at least look it up and see what they're doing.
Yeah.
I think effects will probably be on a lot of people's radars already, like to be looking that one up. So maybe dig around when you're on the site and see what they're up to. It's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll be seeing, you know, Alamo Drafthouse in L.A. one day, and all of this will all culminate and we'll get to go to screenings like this.
Maybe you'll get to pick them.
Hey, if it's psyched by the 4D witch, sign me up.
We can make that happen whenever you want.
Okay.
Just let us know.
Oh, that's magic.
Yep.
Though I'm scared to rewatch.
Don't be. It gets better because you start to notice details that weren't there before.
I'm taking you guys to that one. Trust me. Thanks for coming on. It's really fun. I love talking to people who've seen stuff that we haven't.
After really
years of doing
this,
it actually is refreshing.
A lot of great recommendations.
Have you done Wolf Guy yet?
Wolf Guy? You mean
Wolf Guy.
The film
Wolf
or?
Guy. Wolf Guy. With Sonny Chiba.
Oh. No.
There's some other Sonny Chiba films that we've discussed, but we have not seen Wolf Guy.
Wow. Okay.
Where to begin with Wolf Guy? Holy shit. Well, he's a reporter who happens to be from a lost lycanthrope tribe, and he's the last of his tribe, but he's a reporter in Tokyo, and he discovers a glam rock gang being terrorized by thugs. They're being murdered. This glam rock band is being murdered one by one by a tiger spirit. And then Sonny Chiba is kidnapped by the mob in a Cronenbergian testing facility to harness his tiger wolf power. And then in the finale, he's unleashed to unleash his wolf power. It's one of the most off the charts
films.
The full title, Wolf Guy, Enraged Lycanthrope.
Yes.
Now, do you guys Nocturna?
Oh, with Brother Theodore? Nocturna?
Do you Nocturna?
Yeah.
Okay.
Of course.
Nocturna, 1979. Really hard to find. I have a bootleg if you guys want to borrow it.
Isn't there a new movie that came out right now called Nocturna?
Yeah. It's Nocturama.
Anyway, it's a dance. It's a disco vampire movie about Dracula's granddaughter with Brother Theodore, and it's in New York City, and they stole every fucking shot. And all great soundtrack.
He plays like the Renfield. He's like Nocturna.
Our coworker Christina Cacioppo, who's a creative director at Alamo Drafthouse in Brooklyn, tracked down the woman who stars as Nocturna.
She moved back to the Middle East and became like a. Wasn't she some type of royalty? I could be wrong.
Really?
On that one.
Yeah,
I
so she's back in New York now.
Oh, seriously? Then maybe she was not Middle Eastern royalty. But yeah.
All right. Well, lots to look forward to.
Yes. Yep.
and thank you guys so much for having us.
Thanks. Really, great really to have fun.
Thank you.
We only spread the word that we love.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming, and good trip back to Austin.
Thank you.
See you soon.
Take care.